Good evening. Not getting off to a good start. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City Council meeting, City of Arroyo Grande, for Tuesday, January the 25th. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Dickens.
Here.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Here.
Councilmember Arnold.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Costello is absent tonight. And Mayor Ferrara.
Here. Let's see. Is there a representative from Knights of Columbus here, by chance? Okay. What about Pastor Robert Underwood? Is here? Okay, good. Then if you will join, if you'll stand and join me in the flag salute, I'll lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance and then remain standing for Pastor Robert Underwood from First United Methodist Church, who will give our invocation this evening.
Ready? Provide for the homeless, the hungry, the weary, the poor, and give us compassion for the needs of all here in our town and your people around the world, especially for those who suffer from the war in Iraq and the natural disaster in Southern Asia. To the reverence of you, almighty and righteous and loving God, we pray. Amen.
Thank you, Pastor. Okay, that takes us to item number 5, special presentations. And we have two very special presentations this evening. I'm going to step down from the dais to present them. At this time, I would like to request Mr. Mitch Chavez and Mr. Cord Schmidt come forward, please. So up here, gentlemen, where the camera can get you. Well, it's my pleasure this evening to preside over what has now become a more enlightened recognition of the work of our employees, and I think largely due to the efforts of Steve Adams, our city manager, and the department heads, we're going to pay better attention to the good work that you do. And the two of you, I can't think of a better example to kick off the program than the work that the two of you did. And I'd like to share with our audience what this presentation is all about. The city recently initiated a program of periodically recognizing employees for outstanding service in order to reinforce the organization's values. It is being referred to as the Platinum Service Club because it represents service above and beyond the call of duty. This evening, we are recognizing two employees from our Parks and Recreation Facilities Department. During the recent heavy rains, the city experienced over 3 feet of overflow water at the Soto Sports Complex into the basin referred to as Volunteer and Acada Fields. While these fields have been designed to serve as an overflow basin in times of emergencies, they are very expensive to repair when damaged from flooding and are most heavily used fields in the city. In order to save the turf from damage, Mitch Chavez and Cord Schmidt worked over 25 hours of overtime in 3 days to save these fields, which demonstrated their pride and commitment to the city's facilities. It is estimated that this work also saved the city at least $50,000 that would have been required to repair these fields. So, gentlemen, it's my pleasure to present to you a mayor's commendation. And I'll read one of them to Cord Schmidt on this 25th day of January 2005 in recognition of your membership in the Platinum Service Club for service above and beyond the call of duty.
So, wow, Cord. Thank you.
Pleasure to present this to you. Don't go away. And okay, what a great way to kick the program off, Steve. All right, that will take us to item 6, agenda review. Item 6A, move that all resolutions and ordinances presented tonight be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. That takes us to item 7, community comments and suggestions. This is an opportunity for any member of the public to come forward and address an item that is any item that is not on this evening's agenda. The Brown Act restricts the council from taking formal action on matters that are not published on the agenda. We would ask that you limit your comments to 3 minutes or less and please address the council as a whole. Any members of the audience that would like to come forward at this time? Okay, no takers. We'll close community comments and suggestions. We'll move to item 8, which is consent agenda. This is a group of items the council has had an opportunity to review in depth. We normally approve consent items in one motion. Unless there is an item on consent that any member of the council would like to pull for further discussion or in-depth review. What is the will of the council?
None.
Okay. We have no items to be pulled this evening, so I will entertain a motion for approval of consent items 8A through 8F.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any discussion? Hearing none. Is there anything to read in there tonight?
No, Mr. Mayor, there's not.
Okay, thanks, Tim. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. Takes us to item 9, our first public hearing this evening, consideration of a proposed ordinance adding Chapter 8.38 to Title 8 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code, providing for licensing of tobacco retailers. Good evening, Chief.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor. As you mentioned before you, you have a proposed ordinance regarding adding Chapter 8.38 to Title 8 of the Code. This would provide for licensing and regulations of retailers of tobacco products. In October of 2000, the city enacted a series of ordinances concerning the regulation of the sale and distribution of tobacco products. In March of this year, the tobacco control program from the San Luis Obispo County Public Health Department approached us and asked us if we would consider enacting a licensing ordinance for retailers of tobacco products. And what you have before you tonight is that ordinance, or that proposed ordinance. This ordinance would accomplish two things. Number one, it would allow for the recovery of the police department's costs in enforcing various tobacco control laws. The second thing that the ordinance would do would provide a regulatory mechanism whereby retailers of tobacco, this does this has a license mechanism whereby if the retailer's employee or agent does violate the law and does sell tobacco products to underage persons, then the license can be suspended or, in the case of a multiple repeat offender, revoked, which would take away their privilege or ability to sell tobacco products. The hammer there, you might say, is the retailer has more, there's more at stake because they themselves can be held responsible. And there would be provisions built into that, too, that would recover our costs should there be actual violations. One of the things that I think we brought out in the staff ordinance and in the findings of the ordinance itself, or I should say staff report and the findings of the ordinance, is that a survey conducted in 2003 by the Tobacco Control Program indicates that even though we have, I think, a pretty good enforcement program in Arroyo Grande, that we're still experiencing, or at least in their survey, we're experiencing, I think, a significant number of violations by retailers within our city. Their survey showed about 33.3%. In other words, a third of our retailers were still violating the various laws and ordinances as compared to a 17.10% statewide average. Also on a survey, a separate survey showed that about 81% of the high school juniors and 63% of the high school freshmen stated that it was easy to obtain tobacco products in the South County area. And I think that we're talking about South County in general, not just the city of Arroyo Grande. The city of Arroyo Grande has long been a leading advocate of tobacco safety and municipal regulation. We were one of the first cities, I think, in the area to do actual undercover operations in terms of trying to catch people that were selling tobacco products to minors. I would like to note that back in 2003, the city of San Luis Obispo adopted an ordinance very similar to this one. In developing this particular ordinance, which I think is necessary to help, A, alleviate our costs in enforcing this program, and B, again, adding additional accountability to the retailers or, in terms of the sales of these products. In developing this ordinance, we worked very closely with the Tobacco Coalition. We looked at the San Luis Obispo ordinance, which was a model ordinance to begin with, and I think the result is a very good, comprehensive ordinance that should have an effect, the desired effect that we want. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions or clarifications in the staff report?
No questions this time.
I had just one.
Okay.
While we spell out the penalty if you violate one, two, three times, it mentions that there can be fines, but those are not specifically spelled out. Was there a reason for that?
Well, the fines will have to come back to you at the next reading of the ordinance. If you decide to go forward with it tonight, at that time we would also present you with a resolution to establish the licensing provision and the
My name is Trina Long, and I am a health educator with the San Luis Obispo County Tobacco Control Program, and I'm here tonight to voice my support for the proposed ordinance based on the following information. It has been well established in numerous studies since the 1980s that active enforcement of state and local tobacco sales to minors laws reduces the number of retailers who illegally sell tobacco to minors. In contrast, research has shown that merely educating store owners and clerks about illegal tobacco sales does not reduce sales to children over time. A comprehensive retail tobacco licensing program that includes fees high enough to pay for enforcement has been shown to be the most effective policy at reducing illegal sales by merchants. California Penal Code 308A and STAKE Act are two laws that make it illegal to sell tobacco to minors. The STAKE program conducts approximately 2,500 compliance checks each year. That means that the state only checks about 3% of the estimated 80,000 tobacco retailers in California each year. These laws have little effect because local police and sheriff departments cannot be expected to run an enforcement program without funding. Because of the lack of enforcement, retailers continue to sell tobacco to children. Good public policy requires sufficient funding to a program so that it may achieve its stated goals. Trying to fund an enforcement program through penalty licensing, which only requires the retailers who break the law to obtain a license, or high fines or funds appropriated from other sources that may disappear after a year or two of funding, does not allow for a sustainable program with regular enforcement. Establishing annual fees is also good public policy because it sends tobacco retailers the message that the community is serious about tobacco retailer laws and that there are serious consequences for those in violation. Tobacco retailers must take their responsibility seriously, and the community must hold them accountable. It is also commonplace for governments to establish licensing programs to regulate businesses and to protect the public through enforcement. These programs and the related fees are not established as a way to punish businesses, but rather as a way to regulate them to ensure that a few bad apples do not give the industry a bad name. The only businesses that are punished are the ones who violate the law. Licensing makes sense where government has an interest in ensuring that businesses comply with the law and it makes sense in the case of tobacco, because keeping retailers from selling tobacco to children is crucial if we want to prevent future generations from suffering a lifetime of addiction to one of the world's most deadly products. Children in our community are buying cigarettes from retailers now. So now is also the time for us to enact a local tobacco policy that funds ongoing enforcement to help prevent future generations from suffering from tobacco-related disease and addiction. So on behalf of the San Luis Obispo County Public Health Department and on behalf of the San Luis Obispo County Tobacco Control Coalition, I hope that you will support the proposed ordinance 2 in its entirety tonight. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else? Okay. Seeing no one, we will close public comment on item 9A and bring this back. Councilmember Arnold. What, Member Dickens?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I too I'm real supportive of this particular ordinance, and I think that it's our responsibility to help regulate and recover the costs that are incurred by our city staff to go out and do the stings and to monitor and regulate this particular illegal tobacco use. As a high school counselor, I'm always taken back by students who choose to participate in tobacco use and so forth because of we all know and we're all educated about the health risks involved. A couple of things I just wanted to point out to the public this evening, and I didn't realize this, but part of our ordinance and that we're going to be reading has a lot of whereases, and one of the whereases is despite the restrictions, minors continue to obtain cigarettes and other tobacco products at alarming rates. Each year, an estimated 924 million packs of cigarettes are consumed by minors 12 to 17 years of age. I find that unbelievable, but and appalling that we're allowing this to happen. And I think a lot of it has to do with just the inability for local jurisdictions to set the standard and to go out and do the appropriate stings and to monitor at an adequate basis. And I know that our community has been proactive in providing a lot of the community outreach and services already. And yet things get tighter and tighter, and I really believe it's the retailer's responsibility. And I think that this type of ordinance will allow them to do their job better, to allow them to be much firmer with when they have a young person that is adamant about trying to purchase purchase tobacco and really kind of lays the hammer down. So I think it's appropriate, and I'd really hope that it curbs the access and hopefully discourages young people from starting to get addicted to tobacco. So with that in mind, I have no problems with the ordinance before us, and I think it's prudent for us to adopt it. Thank you.
Thank you. I would echo my colleague's statements and observation relative to this item, and just want to also indicate that the focus seems to be largely on cigarettes, but that's not the case. This ordinance reaches to other tobacco products as well, to include smokeless tobacco. And I know part of the education process, and we tend to forget these things, but recently I had the unpleasant experience of observing someone who had recently undergone surgery for throat and mouth cancer because of extensive use of smokeless tobacco. It is not a pretty sight and not something that I think anyone wants to endure. So particularly where there's an issue of judgment in our young people, something like this steps up to the plate and fills the gap. And so I support this wholeheartedly. And I was also taken aback with the 33 1/3% occurring in the city. I didn't think we were. I thought we were, far. That takes us to item 9B, consideration of a conditional use permit, 04-005 mixed-use project, two retail units, three office units, one residential unit, 101 Traffic Way.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, council members. We'll see if we get our PowerPoint up on the board for you. This is conditional use permit 04005. It's for a mixed-use building with retail and office units and a residential unit. The proposed project is a 5,512-square-foot property located on the corner of West Branch Street and Traffic Way. As you know, it's a prominent entry into the village. It's also located within the Design Overlay District 2.4 and therefore subject to the design guidelines and standards for historic districts. On the screen behind you is a photograph of the current site with the building on it for your reference if you need it later on. The project proposes a 3,706-square-foot mixed-use building that's two stories with a subfloor. The first floor would have two retail units and an office unit. The second floor would have two office units and a residential unit. And there is a subfloor because of the site slopes that will contain restrooms and mechanical equipment. The exterior of the building is flat. It has a flat roof with cap parapets. It has siding that resembles wood, stone veneer at the base of the building, which is proposed to match the stone that's going to be on the new trafficway bridge upgrade. The building will also feature a boardwalk on the Branch Street frontage, along with raised stone patio on the corner location. Here I have elevations of the project. This is a view of the front of the building looking across West Branch Street. This is a view from looking across Traffic Way. The back of the building as if you're driving up Traffic Way towards West Branch Street. And finally, the east elevation is as if you're walking on the sidewalk on West Branch Street towards Traffic Way. In the middle of the building, where the window is on the second floor, is the approximate location of where the billboard on the adjacent property is. The height of the building on Branch Street varies from 29.5 feet to 31 feet. The maximum height at the rear of the building due to the slope of the lot is 33 feet. The code does allow up to 36 feet with a minor use permit. And for your reference, other buildings within the village center is approximately 31 feet high. The Briscoe building, which is a stone building in the middle of the block, is 30 feet 8 inches. The building that houses Lightning Joe's is 29 feet 6 inches. And the Ron Tall Salon across Traffic Way is 29 feet. On the board is a site plan, and I have enhanced a bit of it when we get to different aspects of this, especially this use of the right-of-way. The applicant proposes to continue to utilize the right-of-way of this property, but he'll place improvements on 7.5 spaces. The applicant wishes to utilize the 20% mixed-use reduction that's allowed in the code. This brings the adjusted required parking to 9.2 spaces. On-site, including part of the right-of-way, the applicant is providing 5 spaces, which leaves us 4.2 spaces remaining. The applicant proposes to fulfill this requirement by the dedication of 240 square feet of Branch Street frontage. The Planning Commission recommended credit for two spaces, but this is purely discretional up to the council to decide. The applicant would also like to satisfy the remaining parking spaces either through an off-site contract or preferably through in-lieu fees if the parking district is expanded or if in-lieu fees are adopted for mixed-use zones. And this is only if the council, of course, adopts this in the future and prior to the applicant obtaining a building permit. The site plan here with blue shows the 240 square feet or 55 linear feet of Branch Street frontage that the applicant proposes to give to the city. This is an aerial view of the site currently for your reference. The Planning Commission reviewed this project and recommended approval on December 7th, 2004. And the Architectural Review Committee also reviewed the project and recommended approval, and it went to that body 3 times just for some minor adjustments. There are two items in the resolution and the conditions of approval. Number 34 states that the applicant should provide an Opticom device. This was talked about at the Planning Commission, and part of the resolution is that the applicant only has to pay his fair share of that Opticom device. That would be determined by the fire chief. And also number 12, the way that the trash container is designed on site to be hidden away does not include the recycling, but the applicant will provide for recycling. It will be on site, but it will be out of view. And those conditions could be changed if that's your opinion. With that, it's recommended that the City Council adopt a resolution approving Conditional Use Permit 04005, and I can answer any questions as well as Rob Strong. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Any questions, clarifications in the staff report?
Could I have you put up the site map again and point out to me where the dedicated section, the part that will be dedicated is?
The applicant is proposing to dedicate this area here that's in blue with the sidewalk that's currently shown in place here. Right now, if you go to the site, it appears that it's retained by a block wall and it tends to slope off. That's where that area is.
And are they going to, as part of this project, actually widen the street? Or is that going to just sit there landscaped at this point?
The applicant proposes to landscape it at this time. It's unknown if the city actually has a plan for widening Branch Street, but staff saw it as an opportunity to think ahead on the project and be ready for a future enhancement. That is the narrowest part of Branch Street at that area.
It's going to be going into, it looks like, a utility room housing the air conditioning units. To the right of that is another doorway. Is that doorway going to be, is it just a facade, or is it actually going to be able to open into the stairway area?
I'm going to have to step away from the mic, but this is the door that goes to the equipment room. It will be ventilated. I don't have a mouse.
Excellent. I'm old now. This is the door that will go to the equipment room. It will be a mesh screen ventilated so that the possibility of the equipment can be located in this area and screened from view. This is an open archway, I believe, that it's shaded, showing shadows here that people walk through, you go up the stairs, and then you come to the main level of the building.
Thank you. So it's not a doorway. Okay, so thank you. And then the windows, the four windows then to the right of that, are those, according to the plans, there is no basement down there. Are those just facades?
I believe it's for ventilation subfloor. And the applicant's representative who designed the building is here that could answer that. I think the idea was if you go through Dixon Walkway right next to Willis and Bennett, underneath you can see that there's some windows there, and that's where the designer came up with this idea to not only ventilate the building but also mimic that style in the village.
Okay. Getting into the stone veneer, when we talk about stone veneer, are we talking about an actual stone product, something that is actual stone that's been, you know, sliced and so forth that will be applied, or are we talking about something that is a look-alike product?
I believe it's a look-alike product. The applicant does have that sample of that here for you to look at, and they would know more about it than I would.
Okay. And again, that's the same product that we're going to be using for the reconstruction of the trafficway bridge.
I believe it is.
Okay. My biggest concern with this particular project is the actual parking lot itself. If you could go to the and I realize this particular property is extremely constrained. As I look at how this is going to function, and of course my wife drives around in a very large Suburban, getting a Suburban in and out of this thing is going to be, you know, pretty much taking up that entire space. My biggest concern is what happens when a trash truck goes in there to pick up the garbage on a weekly basis. Is that trash truck going to need to back out on the traffic way at that particular time? Is that the plan?
I don't know the answer. The applicant is probably the best one for that. But my thought would be you probably wouldn't want a trash truck back on your asphalt
in your building. So they may have to devise some sort of schedule where they could bring the can out to the street prior to the pickup of the trash can. But the applicant, again, can answer that.
Yeah, and I've seen that happen before. Okay, that's just a concern of mine. Is there any plans, and I know it's premature, of course, the adjacent property, ideally, would, when that's developed, when and if that's developed, to have, and I know the staff reports talks about mutual access, and can you describe that process?
The plan sign program is generally approved by the Planning Commission. The idea is to take a look at the signs on the building, make sure that they have similar mounting hardware, that they look uniform. At this time, there's not a planned sign program coming concurrently with this, but the applicant did show signs on the buildings so that you have a general idea of where they're going to be located. And a lot of times we're seeing that you got to design the building with a place for the signs or else they look really awkward. So you can see on these elevations that they have at least thought about where the signs are going to go.
Okay. But that will have to come back at least typically through the architectural review committee and then through the approved by the Planning Commission?
That's correct.
Okay. Can you go back to the overall plan? Tony, can I borrow your pointer here?
Sure.
Yeah. In the plans, it depicts that the applicant is proposing to extend or redo the sidewalk up until this point right here. My question is our bridge reconstruction, where does that stop, and will there be what will happen in this area here from the city standpoint? Will the bridge reconstruction go up to this particular point, or will we have a voided area where we have a sidewalk that's not contiguous after this project and after the bridge project?
We'll let Rob handle that one.
Okay.
Since the city's bridge reconstruction is taking place now, we will ask the applicant to conform to and transition to the curb and gutter on the bridge. There'll be a flare, but there are no other private properties between the bridge and this proposed project, so there may be a slight extension beyond the property line. It will be a continuous sidewalk.
Okay. That'd be great. And my last question, I have two other questions. it's obviously apparent that if this is approved as proposed and the landscaping is put in, that the billboard adjacent to this property will be pretty much ineffective, at least on one side. I'm assuming that it'd be very difficult for them to get some advertising up there. Has there been any communication with the billboard company? And my question is what is that going to look like then after we're done? If they're not going to put any advertising up there, is it going to be blank? Is it going to start to deteriorate? Do we need to put more landscaping up until that billboard decides that maybe it's not economically feasible for that company to continue doing business? We are putting that in an awkward position, I guess.
I'll answer on behalf of the city, and the applicant may have had subsequent conversations. The city has had discussions with the billboard company. The lease expires on the adjacent property, I believe, in approximately 3 to 5 years. I don't recall the specific date. There is actually a catwalk in front of the billboard that actually encroaches across the moved if they try to proceed with development. And that property has recently changed hands, and that we expect a development proposal shortly on that property. There will either be a removed billboard and a visibility of the east-facing facade that you've seen on the drawings, and more or less a little plaza area in front of the new development, or the building could move out towards the street closer. We will also ask a dedication of 6 feet along that property frontage to enable future widening of West Branch Street. And that would affect the billboard as well.
Okay. My last question is, and I'm just, I guess I'm naive about this. When I looked at the mitigation measure number one about water neutralization, it talks about one of the alternatives being an in-lieu fee. I didn't know, or I don't know whether we have an in-lieu fee established specifically for water neutralization. And maybe if you can just help inform me or about what that in-lieu fee is and what we currently have on the books.
There is a water neutralization fee available, established by the Public Works, to accomplish retrofits to achieve water use reduction. We also require all new developments to have conservation features, but essentially there is a program for the city to accomplish the retrofit if they choose to delegate it to the city. Otherwise, they can achieve it on their own. They can find a site and retrofit it, and if they can do it more economically, some developers choose that route.
Well, maybe I'm reading this wrong. Let me see if I'm. I looked at this last night. It looked like that was one option. Yes, it says that the applicant shall complete measures to neutralize the established increase. I'm sorry, the estimated increase in water demand created by the property by either, and then it says here, implementing, as you talked about, the individual water program that utilizes fixtures and designs that minimize water usage, the calculations and so forth and so forth. Then it says, or paying an in-lieu fee. And that's what I didn't realize. I don't know whether we have an established in-lieu fee. That is, and you're saying that we do. Over and above the retrofit program. In other words, does there have to actually be an actual retrofit of either, well, it wouldn't be this, either some other facility, or can they just pay an in-lieu fee and call it good?
The in-lieu fee is actually the fund we've established where we've generated, I can't remember the balance, quite a bit of money, and that is funding the whole program we've initiated this year where we go out and offer a retrofit program to homes throughout the city, and that's where that came from. So.
Thank you. Yeah, okay. Mr. Mayor, that concludes my questions.
Okay. Councilmember Arnold?
Yeah, I just have a few. Thank you. In Planning Commission, I recall us discussing the egress of being right turn only in and out.
Restriction of movement, but in that particular instance, most motorists would realize the hazard and difficulty of attempting to cross four lanes of traffic, which are coming from a variety of directions.
Also, Jim, you mentioned the fact that we do not have an agreement in place right now for the access for the adjacent properties. Is it possible to have some kind of agreement so that we don't approve this with the assumption that this is going to solve problems for the adjacent properties and then find out later that the developer changes his mind and doesn't want to provide that?
The city can certainly include that within the revocable encroachment permit. The only access to either this property or the adjacent properties would be through the city's right-of-way. So we will make that a feature of the revocable encroachment permit. It has been discussed with both the property owner to the east and this property owner. And the driveway, as you can see, is aligned so that the extension to the adjacent property would actually occur with no traverse of the applicant's property. If they choose to use the driveway that provides access to the spaces on this property and excavate the adjacent property to some degree to enable parking, then there would have to be a parking easement established on this property, but that has been discussed with the applicant as well.
Yeah, and that's what I was aware of. I would like to see at least a minimum in there so that we are sure that they have some basic access. Whether or not they want to open it all up and have shared parking, that would be a different issue. Okay. And then I think the last question I have is in reference to the split-face block that separates two properties, and then there's also used for the trash enclosure. on the ARC on November 1st, on their page 6, they asked the same question, why there wasn't stone used. And I didn't quite understand it. It talked about the fact that the trash enclosure, the fence would be underground, so you wouldn't see it. But it would appear to me, at least, that retaining wall you would see. Was there a real strong reason, other than cost, why that was chosen not to be stone?
The applicant has provided, if you look to the side of the property where the wall is, there's going to be planter wells, and the landscaping plan shows vines that grow out along that wall. So the intent is to minimize the impact of that split-face stone with a vining plant. And the trash enclosure does seem to sit down low on the property where it's, the side of it wouldn't be viewed because it's blocked by the landscaping and by the terrain of the site. But also the applicant and the designer can back me up on that.
Okay, thank you. That's all, Mr. Mayor.
Thanks. I have a couple of questions, but I think I'm going to wait and move into public comment on this item. I think if the applicant is here, both the applicant and the architect, so give you an opportunity to come up and make any comments, and I might have a question or two of you, Mark, or Mr. Robichaudi.
Fits in well here, and we worked with staff and the different commission and architectural committees and hope to get an approval tonight. Part of the design process in this particular case has been a mingling of efforts to try to solve a number of issues that were specific to this small piece of property, access being one of them, and I want to address that first because that was a big issue on the project before, and it's a big issue for that whole area down there. Essentially, as Rob mentioned, the driveway placement was determined in this particular project based on not only the needs for this project and to try to get parking that worked here and try to get as much site distance as we could get for ingress and egress, but also to look at those properties that are to the east of here. And in the site layout, if you were to look back at that, as Rob mentioned, there's a spot at the bottom down there that shows where potentially an access would go onto the neighboring property. So it essentially is provided access to the adjoining properties across your city right-of-way. There's just a little tiny chunk, I guess, that is off of this property. And in discussions between the property owner here and the new property owners adjacent, that's kind of where we've come up with a potential for that issue. So I think that we've dealt with that issue and tried to make it as the best possible situation that we could, and hopefully this works. As to the in and out right turn only thing, I do remember a conversation regarding that, and I think it's probably something that signage might help that. I think it's going to be hard to enforce. People tend to go where they want to go, how they want to get there. So I don't think we would have a problem with signing it that way, but I'm not sure that you're always going to get people doing that. There's a number of places, Mid-State Bank, even the project across the street was originally one-way traffic in there, and it operates in two directions now. So it's just hard to make people do what they don't necessarily want to do. But we would be happy to put up signage to try to enforce that. The other issues that seem to be of concern, and that has to do with the access, is the trash truck. And that's something that I really struggled with. This is a tough spot. You're surrounded on basically three sides by street. So it makes it tough to not only get the trash receptacle out of public view, but make it accessible for a truck to get in there, service it, and then leave. Our hope is that when this is done and the adjacent properties develop, as that drive continues on to the east, that will provide a turning area for the truck to make its maneuver and head out. Currently, that's not available because we don't have that drive in place. I think that timing of the pickup is going to be more crucial than anything, and that's something that would have to be worked out with the garbage company to take care of that. But I looked at that very, very hard, and it's just a difficult spot to get it out of without putting it on the street further down when we know more about who's going to be in the building than we do right now as to specifics. I think the other things were dealt with pretty well here. The billboard is one of those things that I think we all wish it would just magically disappear. We're doing our best to try to make that happen. but it is there. It's on the adjacent property, so we don't have a lot of control over what's going on with it other than the things that Rob and Jim have mentioned. I would hope that in the not too distant future it does go away, but I don't know there's much that we can do with that at this point. I wanted to answer a couple of the questions that you had in regards to the elevations and what we were trying to get to. Essentially, the south side of the project where you saw the doors and the windows down below, Jim was exactly right. What we're trying to do is emulate the effect of a basement. We have a significant grade difference between Branch and the parking area, so the use of the stone and trying to make it feel like there's a basement there, that's what we were trying to achieve. Those openings would be such that, you know, you're not going to see through them. They're going to be screened and that, so it's not like you're going to look underneath the building, but it would give that effect so that you get the feeling that there's a basement there and potential for windows. And as to the stone, again, we're trying to tie it into what's surrounding. And so what I did is I went down to Public Works and talked to them about what was going on with the bridge project. And we are going to use exactly the stone that you're going to use on the bridge project to try to tie those two things together. They're very closely related, and we felt that that would be the best way to go with that. It is an artificial stone product. Because of that, that's one of the reasons when you mentioned the split face block that we chose not to use the stone on the wall over there. And the reason being is it's an area that could potentially be subject to vehicle damage. Someone could back up into it. With a stone veneer like that, it could break and actually become more unsightly. But more importantly, as Jim mentioned, we're putting those cutout planters in there. And the reason for that is to plant vine material that will grow on the wall and actually adhere to the wall. So the wall will just essentially disappear at some point. And so our feeling was is a contiguous product rather than an applied product would be better suited so that material can grow on there and stick better and be a longer-term solution. Past that, I don't know that I have any... anything new to shed as far as light goes on this. We are trying to provide something that is going to be an important building to the entry to the village, something that integrates the different levels of the building site and bring in materials that we feel will pick up some of the history of the village in the styling and the materials that are placed on it. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
I do have a couple, Mark. For my own benefit, what is a linear space?
The billboard is actually just about even with where the eave overhang is going to be on the boardwalk. So there's a section of that billboard that's going to be seen just because of the way that the two angle from each other. We're gonna obscure a large part of it. As you enter the village, in fact, from the stoplight over at Traffic Way and Branch and Grand and all that, where that comes together, I believe that the billboard would be obscured. You wouldn't see it. But as you start driving down Branch Street, you're going to see little bits of it, I think, still up there. And obviously, as you drove up Traffic Way towards the intersection, if you looked to your right, you're going to see some of it between
the corner of it.
Yeah.
Okay. The corrugated metal material that will be used for some of the overhang, is that material similar to what is currently being utilized on the barn
in Heritage Walk?
Actually, we looked at that. That was one of the things that the architectural committee wanted us to do. Since that time, and we actually went back to the architectural committee after that, I did some research on that particular material, and it is no longer recommended to be used for exterior siding or roofing. They're apparently having some kind of problem with it. The rusting does not stop, I guess. And one of the other problems with it is staining. If you go to, there's a building in San Luis Obispo on by the railroad there where they put it on a siding. If you go look at that building, even though they used a darker color split face block below the siding, it's stained very badly. So what we have chosen to do is to come away from the natural rusting type material and go to a finished material because of those problems. So it'll
be corrugated metal, kind of a rust-colored finish, but it'll be weather-tight.
Yes, yes.
Okay. And the siding, you indicated it would be a wood-like material. Is that hardy board?
Yes.
Okay. And I think one of the things we asked was for some form of a color board or material sample. Is that the stone that I see there? I was wondering if you could hold that up.
Yes, this is the sample of the stone material and it's the same material that's being used on the bridge, and it emulates the stone look of the building just down the street here.
Looks like the real thing. Okay. The other thing I had, and I'm sure it's probably in there and I didn't see it, but can you just give me a quick indication as to the ADA features here?
Okay.
You want to use this?
Yes, that would help.
Okay.
If I can work it.
Okay. Push the button. Okay. There you go.
Essentially, here's the disabled access parking space right here. And the travel path would be, let's see if I can do this better this way. Travel path would be from here down the sidewalk over to here, and we're going to restructure the sidewalk up here. Alternatively, if for some reason down the road the city decided to cancel the encroachment permit for that access around here and restructure this area in here, the alternative would be to come off of here, and there would probably be over in this area some kind of a lift placed to get you back up to that elevation. Because we need to be able to get from this elevation down to the restroom facilities down below here also. So we have to get to both levels. So it either would be through a long ramp, which in this case we're using the sidewalk around here, or through some kind of a lift over there in the future.
Okay. One last question, and that relates to the issue of trash pickup and recycle. And I have to ask the question, maybe you can answer for John. Are you going to continue to occupy the location with an office or in some form? Is that the idea?
Yes.
Okay. I'm thinking that perhaps an alternative until we have an opportunity to see how the neighboring property is going to impact, let's say, the turning radius and/or pickup of a dumpster size recyclable or trash container, you might want to go to the extra large bins on wheels. And perhaps there's a place, I'm not quite seeing it on the site plan, but on trash pickup days, it would mean a little extra work. But if you roll those out to a place where the truck can grab them, would save a lot of headache. And so I doubt if you're going to have a massive green waste on the site, but who knows? You could probably have the landscaper take it away. But in terms of recycling, it's a very important business-related function and residential program that we have here in the city. So I would think, given the size of the structure and the intensity of use and so on and so forth, that short-term solution might be the rolling bins in place of the dumpster, and that'll save the you'll have to get a few of them, but you can probably fit them in there. They won't be as messy or as noisy, and probably get by with those until you see what happens next door.
I think that would be a good way to try it and see how we can do that.
Okay. While Mark is up at the podium, are there any other questions?
He answered all my questions.
I have one question.
Sure.
Can you put back up the north elevation, the Branch Street elevation? Is the only access to get to the boardwalk, which I realize isn't depicted here, on the very would be the east end of the building, the very left side of this picture, or is there going to be a stairway directly from Branch that lines up with the main entry to the?
Yes. Yes, you can see it right here. There's actually two steps up from Branch right now into the main corridor.
So the boardwalk isn't visible here, but is actually between that little bit of planning we see there and the building. So the boardwalk is, I'll say, disguised by the landscape that sits in front of it.
That's correct.
Okay.
The time and effort the time and effort and detail put into these plans far outweighs any kind of minor concerns that I think that we can address. And I really want to applaud your efforts. This is an extremely visible site. It's constrained by its size. I think that what we have here before us is just a really nice project. I'm really pleased. I think that it's going to fit nicely. When I look at this, this is what I see in my mind as a good representation of what the village is all about. The first project you guys brought before us was not quite so, at least in my opinion. So I'm very pleased with what's before us, and I think that it's going to be a real nice addition, and it's really going to be a nice complement to this particular corner. So with that, I want to thank you for the time and effort put into this project. As I've reviewed the different aspects of mitigation measures, the negative deck that's before us, and the conditions of approval, I think that staff has done a great job of reviewing the things that are necessary for compliance and for making sure that as it's moved forward, that what we get is going to be very much representative of what we're seeing tonight. So I'm pleased with the conditions of approval. I don't have any additions to that. As Mayor Farrar talked about, I think getting that trash truck in there is a concern. It's a safety issue, and I think that as I hear what's going to happen tonight, you know, they're going to do one of two things. They're either going to go into the parking lot and dump, and then they'll have to back out, and hopefully there's two drivers and one will make sure, or they'll be outside and bring the receptacles to them. That happens, and I think that that happens throughout the city, and it's not the best of cases. And I think that once the adjacent property comes before us, that we'll probably address that issue in more detail. But what we have before us today is, I think, a good compromise and is certainly functional and workable. In regards to the overall parking, I can concur with staff in regards to what's being proposed. I'm okay with the reduction due to the mixed use. I'm okay with the additional two spaces for the potential dedication of the property on Branch, and then the in-lieu fees I think will be appropriate. I think we as a city are committed to addressing our parking needs in the village, and it's my opinion that eventually we're going to have to address that through some sort of a structure, and the in-lieu fees are going to be helpful to get us there. I would just comment in regards to the plan signed program that Other than that, I'm pleased with the stone veneer. I think that'll be a really nice addition and really complementary to the look, both to the restored bridge, and I think just highlighting some of the other historic buildings and culverts throughout the village area. So that concludes my comments. I'm ready to move forward with approving the project as presented. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Guthrie.
Yes. I do. We saw this a number of times at Planning Commission, and I compliment staff and the applicant on working their way through, you know, a process that, you know, anything in the village is difficult. In reviewing it at Planning Commission and all seeing here tonight, this is a natural site for, because of the difficulty in developing on this site, for some sort of parking accommodation. Of course, anything in the village also has is open to some sort of parking accommodation, so I have no problem with the parking changes that are proposed here. And I support this bill. I mean, I do have a little bit of concern about the change from the ruts galvanized to the finish, but I will certainly trust architectural review to handle that. I just have some concern that it might be too bright a finish in the end and be less old and look too modern. But I will trust architectural review to take care of that. But I can support this as it's proposed tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yeah, I, too, would like to commend the city and the applicant for the amount of work that has gone into this project. I think everyone has learned from past mistakes that we don't want to error when we're proposing projects in the village. And I do think this is a very workable project. I think it's going to add a lot to the city. I'm very excited to see it built. The only two things I would like to see added to the resolution would to include some kind of revocable permit for the access agreement. It can be at a minimal level just to provide the 20-foot access. It doesn't have to talk about shared parking or anything. And I would also like to see the to include the right turn only signage. I recognize that people will violate signs all the time, but I do think that this is a dangerous corner, and if we can get the majority of the people to at least adhere to a right-hand turn only, we can probably, you know, save some accidents. But other than that, I look forward to seeing this built. Thank you.
Thank you. I too would add my appreciation. I think I recall our first meeting with John and with Mark and Rob. I think you were there as well, and I think everyone recognized the challenges, not only because of the irregular shape of this lot, but its location. There was a heightened sensitivity as to the design and the architecture as a result of what is currently built and existing across the street, and certainly those were our concerns. We wanted to, if we could, recover our gateway again, and I think what we have here, largely due to the cooperation of the applicant and the with the bridge, and I think that entire corner from Traffic Way, the bridge, all the way around the corner of Branch will be exactly what we had hoped for. And so I'm excited about this project. Again, I appreciate the patience and the perseverance to get this project to where it is now. And I know it was back to the drawing board at least a half a dozen times. But what we have now is a product that I think is going to serve both of us well. So I'm, again, excited about this and ready to move forward with it. With that, I will entertain a motion.
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to propose a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande adopting a mitigated negative declaration, instructing the city clerk to file a notice of determination and approval conditional use permit case number 04-005, located at 101 Traffic Way, applied for by John Robiscotti, to include the access agreement and the right turn only signage.
Okay, we have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second that motion. You can ask for clarification.
Okay. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Mayor, it's, I would, I thought about the right turn only, and I can't support that at this point. I don't think this is going to be any different than the project across the street, the Lemos project. I think that that has similar access and it works. And I don't think that it's, I think this project, especially with the driveway being further, I guess, south, is going to be workable without requiring the patrons to do a right turn only. So I don't see the need for it. I think it could be done later down the road. So I can't support that particular amendment. And in regards to the future access, we pretty much, the city has that access as it is now. So I think that's one of the reasons why it wasn't there to begin with. But those are just a couple of my comments in regards to the motion before us.
Okay. Thank you. Let me ask the question with regard to the right turn only to the motion maker. Would you be amenable to would this be something that we could perhaps condition based on the behavior of the situation when it's in? In other words, if we're finding out that the situation is dangerous and we can, in fact, improve it, at some point, can the sign be an after something that we do after the fact?
No. We'd have to impose it now. We could probably draft a condition that may contemplate that, but we'd have to specify criteria and a time frame for doing so. But if that's the direction the council wants to go, give us a minute or so and we can put something together.
I think it'd be easier to, if it's a problem later on, to allow the signs to be removed later on than it would be to try to require them later. If it, in fact, proves to be a problem, I think there's two things. One, we really would prefer that people did make a left turn, even if they do. Even if
place here, just a question of the approach. Let me ask Rob or Steve or Tim, based on what you've heard of the two approaches, which would be more easily imposed at this time?
I would recommend that the amendment, including the revocable encroachment agreement, including the right turn restriction, be included, and that the signs be provided by the applicant. It would reduce liability to both the city and the applicant if it's signed that way and the motorist decides to try it anyway. There are other similar right turn only on Nevada and Bridge as you cross Branch Street. It's not always observed, but it's certainly advisable not to try a left turn at those points.
Okay. All right, then we have a motion on the floor and a second. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, roll call.
I have to interrupt. I'm sorry. We have to develop language for that condition. And then there were some minor tweakings on conditions. I apologize for doing it this late. We noticed it in the very last run through. Condition 38, we'd like to amend to include the water facilities fees. So it would read water meter, service main, distribution, availability fees, and water facility fees payable prior to issuance of building permits. And then we need to add we need to change conditions 48 and 49. We're going to consolidate them so that they're 48A, that would be the fire protection fee, and 48B will be the police facilities fee. And then we'll add a new 49, which is payment of the community center fees, which was inadvertently omitted. And then we'll have to add a new condition. I think it's 102. Unless I didn't see it, there is no current condition requiring a right turn only sign on access to traffic way. Is there, Rob?
No, I was suggesting that it be integrated into the requirement for the city attorney approved encroachment agreement that would be subject to your review.
Why do you want it to be a part of the agreement? I'm not sure I understand.
It would just provide for the installation of the signage as a part of the improvements that are expected by the applicant of the public right-of-way.
And then if that's ultimately revoked, would the intention, and I hate to have this discussion here, is the intention that if it's revoked, the right turn only goes away?
No, but the driveway would be relocated, and at that point the city could establish additional access restrictions if they felt it was necessary. I think whether the driveway is at the current curb line extended or at a potential property line location, that there would still be access provided to at least three on-site spaces. And at that point, we would want right turn in, right turn out only, because you'd be crossing five lanes instead of four lanes. There would be a right turn movement or a double left turn movement to the northbound traffic way, and there's two lanes of traffic southbound on traffic way. So it's the sign would still be necessary, just be really
agreement. We can address this condition as to whether it needs to be modified, but I think a separate condition, 102, just works better.
You got it.
You know, access onto traffic way shall be right turn only and signed accordingly.
Okay. Rob seems to be okay with that. Right? Okay, is that okay with you, motion maker?
Mr. Mayor, since we're cleaning things up, just to clarify number 12 about the recycling, that it should be on-site but out of view, and number 34, the fair share of the Opticon device and not the entire device. I talked about it in the staff report.
Yes.
Okay.
I have one question for Tim. On the access agreement, would that be included into the, or would that be another separate item?
I'm sorry, I glossed over that. I think we needed a little more direction. As I understood it, you were talking about the joint access with the neighboring parcel, some sort of a required joint access agreement, or at least reserve.
Right now they're showing 20 feet that they're willing to provide access to the adjoining process, and I just want to ensure that what they're showing on their plans, there's actually some teeth to that, so that we don't find later that they say, well, we don't want to provide that 20 feet.
And I hate to ask further questions, but that remark is actually shown on their plans as I haven't looked closely at the plans, but is that an element of their plans? Or
on the site plan, it is.
It is shown, but it could be further clarified by extending condition 51 to say including shared driveway to adjoining property to the east.
That would appear to work.
All right. Still acceptable?
Still acceptable.
Okay, still acceptable to the second? Okay. All right, I think we're there. We'll try a roll call.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Thank you. I think the discussion on the motion took longer than the public comment. I'm not quite sure, but I think we got there. So, thank you. Okay, before we get into 9C, we're going to take a quick, very quick, 7-minute break. And council will reconvene at 20 minutes to the hour. All right, council's back in session. And that takes us to 9C, consideration of amended conditional use permit, case number 04-001, to allow financial institution to occupy building J, 5 City Center.
Mayor, members of the council, the city council previously scheduled this meeting in anticipation of a comprehensive traffic study that is under preparation. In the administrative draft, we hit a few glitches, asked the consultant to extend and correct the traffic study to address issues that had not yet been included. That study will be complete February 1st at the absolute latest, and it does in draft form identify mitigation potentials. We would like to follow council instruction, bring this back concurrent with the pad I reconfiguration when the comprehensive traffic study can be distributed to the council, and the applicant and property owner of the center have been advised that staff will recommend continuance to the February 8th agenda, at which time all three items will be available. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
I do have a question, Rob. The traffic study that's being conducted now, how does that relate to the traffic model, which we're working on a joint meeting with the Traffic Commission and the Planning Commission? They're both being done by OmniMeans, is that correct?
Yes. OmniMeans utilizes the model which has been calibrated, and they have provided for peak hour conditions and related week-long studies to determine actual peak hour. They are utilizing counts performed in November of actual driveway.
Okay. I didn't see you sneaking up there, Don. But let me ask a question on the counts that are being taken. I see the counters out, the hoses out on Rancho Parkway, and I see them out on Branch up to Rancho Parkway from Briscoe. Are all of the driveways being counted in the center? Is there going to be a cumulative count?
I believe so. I'm sorry, Rob. I think that they're counting all of the ins and outs of that particular area.
I guess my question is, are there counters on the two exits further towards Camino Mercado?
There was previously counts on all of the shopping center driveways November 17th. They are taking counts on the primary entrance to the Phase 1, both Rancho Parkway driveways to Phase 2 and the Rancho Parkway access. They will compare those counts, which were week-long traffic counts on those four driveways, plus the intersection of West Branch and Rancho Parkway, and they will be able to clearly calculate all of the traffic conditions comparatively using those. I think there were originally 10 locations on site and more than 10 locations off site. Now they're focused down to the supplemental study to determine peak hour in the immediate proximity of Rancho Parkway and West Branch, and to factor all counts to reflect the actual peak hour.
Okay, let me ask the question again just to make sure I'm hearing what I think I'm hearing. Are all of the driveways being counted right now? Are we going to be, are we going to be dealing with current data all the way around that shopping center?
Current as of November 17th when the counts were taken on all the driveways plus all the off-site locations and sampled in the immediate proximity of the Pad I and Phase 2 and the Rancho Parkway West Branch. But the study report will address all of the locations to reflect experienced peak hour. So if there's a higher peak hour experience than was counted on what on November 17th in the peak hour counts that are taken in the sample locations. They will factor up those specific locations and give a count. Every day varies, obviously. The week-long count that required the tube counters so that they would have a continuous comparison of all hours of the day and for a full week, including a holiday, were done recently. And that information was, the counts terminated on Monday. So that information is now being analyzed by the local company and the traffic consultant, OmniMeans. And the traffic study really is at your discretion. If you find a refinement of the model that has been previously used on all other studies, that was basically the Higgins traffic study model used at the general plan level in 2001. So this, I think, is a better, more accurate, more calibrated to current conditions model. And any traffic study is a professional judgment exercise. It's not a precise science, but it's certainly one of better precision if you have more counts and more comparisons and an accurate model. I think the model is about as good a tool as any community has, better than any previous model, and it still may have some imperfections, but I think it is representative. And now that we have additional counts, I think we'll be able to question the consultant. We have asked the consultant to be here on February 8th, which was another reason he could not be here this evening under any condition, so we said we would prefer to have it continued until the traffic consultant could be present to respond to council concerns.
Okay. Other questions for staff on this report?
I have none. No, no questions.
Okay. There's a recommendation that we open this, since this item was noticed as a public hearing. There's a recommendation that we open the public hearing and hear any comments from the audience. If there's anyone who would like to come forward and comment on 9C, this would be an opportunity for you to do so. No one? Okay. We'll close public comment on 9C, bring this back. Council Member Guthrie, why don't you start us off?
Well, I do think it's certainly appropriate that the traffic study is complete as possible. So obviously, not reviewing it tonight would be the best approach here. I do, based on the discussion, just wonder if maybe we need to put up the site map and maybe go over what is being counted to satisfy everybody that in fact the counts that that need to be done or being done, so that they could at least be maybe be done in the interim, or at least be prepared to demonstrate why they're not necessary. So if you have a site map, I think that might be a good way to clarify this.
I didn't bring the file. I can certainly obtain the site map. I would caution, however, that if your intent is to expand the counts and want to go back and recount all of the locations,
That isn't my intent was I'm still not sure what's being counted based on the discussion that just took place, and I thought I knew. So
let me try to describe it again. There are two driveways accessing phase two, which is the site on which Trader Joe's and Building J are located. Those driveways are both recently counted for a week-long period. There is a driveway into phase one directly opposite the Trader Joe's first access off of Rancho Parkway. That driveway was counted. Rancho Parkway was counted, and it was counted also at all of the approaches to the intersection of down to Grand Avenue were counted originally on November 17th. And with that data, the consultant will be able to compare the week-long counts with the November 17th weekday counts and factor anything accordingly. And the purpose for having the supplemental week-long count was to determine the actual peak hour, including a holiday. So it was a January 21st. I think they took the weekend of the 19th, 20th, 21st, all the way through to Friday, terminated the counts after they had a full week and sent it back for analysis. So there is an abnormal number of counts that have contributed to this study, and the analysis will be completed, and it did use the traffic model to distribute and calibrate the actual counts, but they will compare what the model estimates with what the actual experience has been on the roadways.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? I have one request, and that is that before this comes back to us, I'd like to see the study as opposed to, I'd like to have it in the Friday packet as opposed to hearing a presentation on it without having an opportunity to review it in greater depth. So if the timing doesn't work with a consultant to have that prepared in time for distribution to the council with ample time for review, then we may want to push it to the second meeting.
Absolutely. That was our criteria for distributing the reports for this agenda. We could have actually had the data for you in advance by today for the day, for discussion of that data, but determined since we couldn't have it in the packets last Friday, that's when the determination was made to postpone it to the following meeting. So that's the criteria we're using in terms of determining if it's ready to be distributed yet for an item.
There's clearly a focus on the whole issue of circulation in and around that center, and so I would encourage staff in conversing with a consultant and coordinating the completion of the study to make sure that he spends time and puts forth a comprehensive product so that we don't have a lot of conjecture. It's based on fact and not estimates, not trade stats, but it's based on the behavior of that particular shopping center and the circulation system that serves it. So, and I for one plan on going through that study in depth. So, and I appreciate ample time to do that. Okay. We have a recommendation to continue this item to the February 8th meeting. Is there a motion to support that?
I'll move that we continue this item to the February 8th meeting.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
The process of changing ownership be retrofitted with low water use plumbing fixtures. We did some research, and we have a program that's before you this evening. But the purpose of the program would be to aid in the achievement of water efficiency throughout the city. The program being proposed this evening for council consideration is similar to other retrofit programs being required by agencies in the state, throughout the state, as well as our county. I think there's three other cities, as well as the Cambria Community Service District, that are also requiring low-flow plumbing fixtures be installed at the change of ownership. The process that we're proposing this evening is kind of a twofold process. It requires the owner or a contractor, a licensed plumbing contractor, install the fixtures. That they need to complete a form verifying that the work has been completed, and then they obtain a certification from the city acknowledging that the installation of the water conservation plumbing fixtures is complete, which will be presented at escrow. The cost of the retrofit is borne primarily by the property owner. However, there is also a provision that allows the owner to request a retrofit through the city's existing plumbing retrofit program that's ongoing right now, as outlined in the water conservation program that the council approved. This will be the introduction to the ordinance, and with that, I'm available to answer any questions.
Are there questions for Don? Councilmember Dickens?
Don, I have a couple questions. When we talk about the criteria for low water use, is that something that's specified somewhere in a chart in regards to what is deemed a retrofit? It's in other words, we're taking these plumbing fixtures, replacing them with these, and that will then achieve an optimal low water use. So do we have a criteria, a chart that then that lists what that is and what our anticipated results are?
Yes, we do. We're following the Uniform Plumbing Code. So the Uniform Plumbing Code, in effect at the time, indicates what low-flow fixtures are, and we will use that as our guideline and criteria when specifying what type of fixtures would be required as low-flow.
From what's available out there on the market, obviously there are all kinds of different designs and such, you know, for bathroom fixtures and so forth. Is it your understanding that there is with every type of design, there's different types of units that can be considered low flow as opposed to not? I mean, is there versatility with selection in products, I guess, is what I'm looking after?
Well, I after looking at all the catalogs that I've looked at, there is a definite a variety of shapes and sizes and colors, but the criteria is pretty well set as far as what use there would be. For instance, low flow for toilets is 1.6 gallons. For shower heads is 2.5 gallons per minute. Those sorts of things.
Monitor that. How do we know? The city's not informed every time a home or any commercial unit is sold. So how do we know? Is this on good faith, or are we requiring the escrow companies to notify us? Where does this come from, and how do we know when a home is sold?
Well, basically, we're following the guidelines established from other retrofit programs. And the way that they're generally set up is that the homeowner is on his own. There's an honor system here that the retrofit has been completed, and that particular home has fixtures that are low flow or low water use. And they come in and they certify that to us, and we write a certification that to the escrow company saying that that is the case. Now, in the provisions of the ordinance, there are penalties and infractions that if we do in fact find that that isn't the case, that the new owner must put those fixtures in, and then we will go and inspect and verify. But the basic program is basically the honor program, and that's generally and primarily the way other systems or other programs have been set up.
What department or which staff is going to be there then for the public to go to first obtain the certificate? What are we talking about? The water conservation certificate, and then which staff is going to be there then to check it off to make sure that, yes, it's in compliance?
We will have several different staff members available to do that. We'll have some in our office here across the street, and we'll also have someone available at the corporation yard. We have a water services worker who will be trained and that sort of thing, and to fill out those forms.
And is it the honor system in regards to however the applicant or seller has filled this out that it's actually being done that way?
That's correct. Yes.
Councilmember Dickens, with regard to the enforcement problem, it's likely that a lot will slip under the radar screen. That's what happens with due-on-sale type of ordinances. It's incumbent on the city in the very beginning to work with title companies, to work with escrow companies, to work with all the brokerage firms, and to make it clear that this is a requirement imposed by law and there are penalties if you don't comply. Beyond that, it is the honor system. But it's really up to the city to communicate effectively, to give actual notice to everyone that's involved in the process, and then just to hope that people comply. But of course, those transfers that take place outside of the normal realm may in fact slip through the cracks. But you know, we hope to get a fairly good compliance rate.
Has there been any communication with the other cities that have already adopted this ordinance as to the increased workload that this would create then for your department?
We didn't go into specific workload requirements or issues, no. Based on the ability of spreading this over several different personnel, I'm assuming that our workload, there's a mechanism for getting these items free. And so what we've found is that, based on just comments from the staff, is that there is a lot of cooperation in getting this these items retrofitted. So just based on that, I don't believe that there's a lot of penalties or prosecution of people that are not doing it.
And my last is it's not really a question, but more of a comment. It's, I guess, if we're looking at getting cooperation, why wait for the sale of a house? Why not get cooperation now? We have a retrofit program, and that would reduce it. I think that I'm leaning towards just the ineffectiveness of this particular ordinance and how it would affect the city, and I think it's kind of a goodwill thing, but I'm not sure it's going to be all that productive. I think that if we were really had individuals who wanted to do this and it would be done. We have the monies. We have the program set aside. I'm not sure what the catalyst. I'm trying to think what the catalyst would be to then, get that retrofit done at the cell, as opposed to why not do it now? Because there's a economic benefit, certainly a conservation benefit. I'm really not asking for a response. It's just more of a rhetorical question that I guess I have some philosophical problems with what's before us. So thank you for your responses.
I have a question if no one else does.
No questions.
Okay. Having recently gone through, year and a half, gone through a real estate transaction myself, before the transaction could be complete, the whole process was subject to a very detailed home inspection. And I'm not sure where it's driven, whether it's now a requirement by law that a home inspection take place. The way it was presented to us as sellers at the time, I don't know if the buyer is the one that drives it or requests it or how that works. But it would seem to me that it would not be that arduous of a task to send a notice out to all of the escrow companies, all of the real estate companies that serve our city, and to those organizations that do conduct home inspections. And what came out of the home inspection was essentially a punch list. And so it was negotiated. These are the things that are wrong. Now you decide these are the things that are in code that the seller has to fix. And it would seem to me that that with a proper foundation and groundwork, if a home inspector were to come into this transaction and say, okay, this is taking place in the city of Arroyo Grande. City of Arroyo Grande has a requirement for a low-flow toilet. So I'm going to add this to the inspection report, and it's going to have to be done. You guys decide, seller and buyer, who's going to pay for it. It's part of the negotiation, but it still has to be done. So it would seem to me that we...
Before we get to this process, but this is kind of a stopgate for those that slip through, that we think we can definitely hit him up at this place and make sure it gets taken care of at that place for those that we missed through the other process.
Okay, I have kind of a general question regarding the retrofit program. I think I can slip it in under this item without Tim giving me dirty looks, but. Have we had any feedback as to the operational aspects of the particular low-flow toilets that we're installing? Any problems with the flushing mechanisms at all? Have we had people complain about it?
We have had some feedback, and it's all been positive. They've all found that the toilet flushes fine and it works perfect. You know, it works to their satisfaction. So yes, we had some feedback, and it's all been very positive.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Anything else? All right.
We're in questions right now.
We're still questions and clarifications.
Okay.
Did you have a question?
No, I just have comments.
All right. All right. It is a public hearing, and if there is a member of the audience who would like to come forward, comment on 9D, this would be an opportunity.
Steve Ross, 211 Garden Street. A couple of years ago, I went through this process in Marin County, where I sold a home. And there, what they required, the county required, it wasn't a city requirement, it was a county requirement. They required that each home be inspected by a home inspector, and that that report be turned over via the real estate agent of the seller to the county. And at that point, the inspection would show what faucets or toilets were or were not low flow within the house. And you were required to change those before closure of the sale or pay an in-lieu fee to the county. In order to prove that you had changed those, you had to submit at escrow or before escrow either receipts, if you did the work yourself, for the plumbing fixtures showing that they were, in fact, low-flow fixtures, or a plumber's receipt for doing the work for you. I know that it might be financially difficult to require every home to be sold, because I don't believe it's an actual legal requirement to have a homeowner's inspection. I know it's done most of the time, but in the case of Marin County, it was required, so that might be something that would need to be amplified in the ordinance, where it would be a requirement to have the home inspected. What they found there was they had a very aggressive retrofit program that didn't work very well, because only people retrofitting were the people that it financially benefited, and those people were people who couldn't afford to retrofit or had old toilets were costing a lot of money and fixtures. People who could afford to flush their toilets without.
So the newspaper doesn't want to comment? No? Okay.
Before we leave public comment, I thought we might want to recognize Mr. Ross, because I believe he was the one that originally came up with the suggestion for this program, which we followed up on. So,
as I recall, that's correct. So see where public comment leads us. So we appreciate that, Steve. In fact, perhaps you would be interested in monitoring the sale of new homes. And if we have a volunteer here. Okay, we will close public comment, bring it back for council comments. Councilmember Arnold.
Yes, everybody else had a chance to have a little bit of comments during their questions. I've done a fair number of real estate transactions, and the one thing that I'm finding more and more is that realtors are almost requiring you to get a home inspection to cover themselves. And so while it's not a mandate, I think that it's such an easy item, especially now with where real estate prices have gone, that you're going to see that. I also see title companies really looking to cover themselves. And so if we make this known to the title companies out there, I don't think we're going to have a problem with them having this as a checklist for them to ensure that, just like water heater straps now are required on everything, and basically you're required to show that you have done that. So I don't think this will be ineffective. I would like to encourage our citizens to take advantage of it. When I did look, because you had mentioned earlier, Steve, the dollar amounts in the fund, and there are actually over $692,000 there. So there's actually a sizable amount of money there to take advantage. The answer to the question as far as Councilmember Dickens had as far as the availability of low-flow appliances, Actually, the building code has required for some time now that you cannot sell non-low-flow devices. So really, everything you see is a low-flow device. And I was actually just at a builder's show in Orlando, the national one, and there's some really innovative stuff out there, and they're very efficient now. There were problems, I think, in the past with the efficiency of the toilets especially, and now they're actually even coming out ones that have both a 0.8 gallon and the 1.6, so that depending on what the use is for. So I definitely support this. I don't know how to say that one. definitely think this is a good step in the right direction. I would like to encourage everyone to take advantage of this if they haven't, but I think we can save a lot of water through this over time. So thank you.
Okay. Councilmember Guthrie.
Yeah, I too agree here that it's going to be the realtors who are going to sort of be the hammer here. They're going to have some liability if, in fact, this isn't in place and a home sells and the new buyer has the responsibility to go in and make the replacement. So I think that they'll take the responsibility to make sure that at least the seller has told them that they've done this, whether they actually see the certificate or not. I also think as far as staff time goes, my understanding is all that staff is doing for the, I'm going to say the majority of these, which are the people who do comply, is filling out a piece of paper in which I'm in favor of this. I think it will provide some measure of relief here. I think probably more of these, particularly the toilets, have already been converted because you can't. I'm dealing with this at the hotel. You can't get anything else. So in fact, by virtue of replacement costs and damage, they're all getting replaced anyway. So I know we probably replaced 20% of ours already just by virtue of replacement. So I'm in favor of this. I don't think it's a huge going to solve a lot of problems for us, but I do think that it's a good move going forward.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I guess I'll have to say that I'm a little pessimistic towards the ordinance and whether it'll actually achieve any the goals that it's looking forth. I think it's I think it sounds good, and I'm not against doing any and every type of effort to look at water conservation efforts, I don't think that we're going to see a lot of folks getting on board and just in. I think it's just my personal opinion is that I really believe that unless there's real meat to this thing, that it's not really going to get done. We're relying on people's good faith, and I really don't believe that we have this penalty clause in here to prosecute for noncompliance. It isn't going to happen. It just isn't. We're not going to do it. So I'm pessimistic towards it, and I think it over the long haul it's going to create more work for staff and not the amount of the outcome and water savings that were really needed. My personal opinion is that we need to concentrate staff time on looking at the issues that are going to create, which we're going to continue to do anyways, but create the additional water resources and reliability on an annual basis. And I think over time, as Councilmember Arnold mentioned, the fixtures that are out there are going to all be low flow anyways. Those are the things that are being purchased. That's what's going to be replaced into homes. We have our retrofit program available. And I guess at this point, I don't see this as being something that's going to be a major influence on our water conservation efforts. So I don't support the ordinance as it's presented this evening. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Doesn't happen often, but I think I have a bit of a different take than the observations that we just heard. While this program may not have a major impact on water conservation, I'm optimistic that it will have some impact on water conservation. And as we all know, the conservation program is not just based on retrofit. It's multifaceted. This is yet another piece of the overall program.
So while it's not going to be the cure-all, it will certainly contribute to the direction and the goal that we're trying to achieve. Water conservation is one of our policies and will continue to be. So a citation at the most, which simply says, if you want the citation to go away, then put in a low-flow toilet. In other words, it isn't going to be punitive to the extent of driving someone to a fine. I think what we're attempting to do here by putting some teeth into the ordinance, regardless of the degree that it could be enforced, what we're looking for is some compliance and motivation to comply. So I see enforcement in this case at the very most being a citation, sort of like an equipment violation. If you were, driving down the street and, one of our Arroyo Grande's finest stopped and gave us a citation, you take that to court and the judge says, did you fix it? If you did, then the whole matter goes away and we now have someone else who's contributing overall to the conservation to the water conservation program. So I think from a cost-benefit standpoint, the cost being the outlay of staff time and the expenses related to that, I'm trusting you, Don, based on your observations of how much of an impact this would have day-to-day. I see this as a plus and yet another thing that works in favor of the overall program. So I can support it. All right. With that, I will entertain a motion.
Get to the right page here.
I'd like to make a motion, an ordinance of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande adding Chapter 13.06 to Title 13 of the Arroyo Grande Municipal Code regarding implementation of a mandatory plumbing retrofit program and procedure upon the change of ownership of real property.
I'll second that motion.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
No.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. All right, that takes us to 9E. Boy, we have a lineup of public hearings tonight. Thank you, Don. Consideration of a resolution to adjust the in-lieu fee for off-street parking in the parking and business improvement area of the village.
Mayor and members of the council, the basic recommendation is to adopt a resolution increasing the in-lieu fee that currently exists in the parking and business improvement area of the village from $4,057 to a proposed amount of $12,000 as recommended by the Downtown Advisory Parking Advisory Board and the Planning Commission to recover the estimated cost of land acquisition and one-half the basic cost of paving, grading, and other estimated improvements. This does not involve city revenues, although there is a special fund in which these fees would be placed and expended only for public parking purposes. The background that is outlined in the staff report points out that the original criteria for in-lieu certificates was established in 1969 and 70, concurrent with the village parking and business improvement area, and it stated that it was supposed to be based on the land value and one-half the cost of construction to that figure that escalated it to the $4,057. It's evident, however, that in the last 3 years during our parking advisory committee meetings that the committee was very resistant to any additional expansion of the parking district unless and until the in-lieu fee were more adequate to enable the development of parking if it only covered the cost of construction and did not include the cost of land, that they did not want to enlarge the district to the west, north, east, and south as appropriate because it would substantially expand a potential deficiency, particularly related to new development. There are public hearings planned for February and March. The Downtown Parking Committee is meeting February 23rd to
review again the previous recommendations that have been considered by the previous Planning Commission. We will return to the Planning Commission on March 1st with a public hearing and a full notice to all of the property owners and businesses within the proposed expanded area for the parking district. This action would basically set a fee that is documented to be a mid-range estimate of the cost of land acquisition and the cost of minimal parking lot improvements. It certainly, if a improved site with buildings or improvements had to be acquired and removed, and if future proposals of parking structures were involved, the fee would have to be significantly higher, more than double, perhaps as much as quadruple, the suggested fee of $12,000. The fee of $12,000 is based upon a recent appraisal of property in the vicinity of the city parking lot behind this building. It's an undeveloped site, which we had an appraisal on. The appraisal covered mixed-use and commercial zone properties throughout the city to arrive at a land value, and surprisingly, there is a consistent value estimated by the appraisals. We have not yet completed that negotiation, and it could be that it will require more than the appraised amount to acquire the property. The most recent estimate of improvements is, again, very generic, based upon grading, paving, landscaping, lighting, conservatively estimated at $10 a foot. It would take approximately $4,000 to develop a space if you own the land. So combine those two. We will start with this recommended adjustment to the fee, which will triple the existing fee. And if in the next year we proceed with the actual parking project and determine that more money is required per space, we will return again next year with them along Grand Avenue, along other commercial or mixed-use areas, even potential multifamily areas, and based upon districting of the city, appropriate in-lieu fees could be established if there are different types of programs approved by the City Council. This proposed fee would be coordinated and used in the representations of the public hearing process, notifying the proposed expansion of the district. All of the pending projects, and there are four that involve approximately 20 off-site parking places, the two that were discussed this evening, and adjacent properties, some on La Pointe, some on Bridge Street, all are going to look towards this in-lieu fee program as a way of implementing a limited number of off-site spaces. It's very difficult to acquire property for two public spaces and make them perpetual to last with the building. So the developers prefer to have a means of paying a fee to the city, and the city can amass those fees and do multiple project in lieu, so we could develop a parking lot for 20 spaces by the pending projects that are anticipated. This is a public hearing, and we would again make further public hearings announcing the in-lieu fee, and if there's any additional questions that the council has, I'd be happy to respond.
Questions for Rob on the staff report?
Just one quick one, Rob. Is there some mechanism by which this is reviewed everywhere, like other, I'll call them impact fees, that are reviewed every year to be updated? I mean, this is a huge step, partly because it really hasn't been reviewed, I'm going to say, properly as far as the cost of developing a space for 10 years. So is there anything in here that actually includes it in our general review, or is it something that would require another public hearing to change it from $12,000 to $13,000 next year?
The intention is to provide an annual review. If there are
actual appraisals or projects available to assist in the estimate, it would be more accurate. Otherwise, it has been the practice of the finance director to return with at least a cost of living increase, and we could include the cost of real estate escalations in that. So it might do more than just the construction cost increase to reflect property values. The biggest difficulty, obviously, is undeveloped land is becoming in short supply. So we may have two or three more opportunities to acquire property before we have to acquire improvements, demolish, and provide improvements. And that's when it really becomes case by case more expensive. Other communities have tended to deal with this on a periodic basis, and most communities are behind the curve. We have been fortunate since the fee was established in the 1980s at $3,000. It was an escalation of a $1,000 1970s fee that was utilized.
Mr. Mayor. Rob, I had a question in regards to, and this has to do with the attachment from the notes from the Downtown Parking Advisory Board, and specifically on table A1, where we talk about the dismissal of partial credits for less than one space. Can you clarify that? What is the intent of staff in regards to, of course, this still needs to go through the Downtown Parking Advisory Board, but right. What is the intent there?
Well, this has been through the Downtown Parking Advisory Board and recommended to the commission. The commission was prepared to recommend it to the council, but that was concluded about August or September, and we felt that it was the inappropriate busy season to notify merchants or property owners of solution to the long misunderstood and difficult to determine parking credits. Whether the proposed solution survives the public hearing process, we are, after two or three years of research, prepared to address the successors of interest of these properties that contributed, some of which are in the district, some of which are out, some of which are in the expansion area, some of which are even beyond that. Some of them have just plain died and or moved on, and we don't know who other than a current a person who remembers roughly why it was contributed. And I think the logic behind dismissing or proposing to dismiss partial parking credits is those who have contributed through long-term survival in the village area to business license fees for a 20-year period have paid an equivalent amount to parking through their business license a tax increment for parking district. It's substantially higher to conduct business in the village, although the business license is very inexpensive. But over a 20-year period, $50 amounts to the same as a $500 or $1,000 contribution. So that was the basis on which we felt we would propose to dismiss. We wanted to acknowledge the contributions and thank them for them. But if the council determines that somebody produces evidence that they were relying upon a credit, and even though it's only half a credit versus a full credit or 10 credits, you can choose to acknowledge and continue those credits at some value, but we think that every request should be verified by documentation on the part of the property owner. We have researched sufficiently, and the largest owners are reflected in Table 2, and we are most concerned about a few of the largest of the large single largest possessor of credits is Andrew David. And in that process, different folks remember different stories as to whether they acquired the credit when they bought the property or whether Mr. David still has personal possession of credits. And his partnerships have come and gone. Those credits might be an alternative way of somebody satisfying a parking demand. They could go buy them
from a possessor of credits over that 20 or 30 year period, their $1,000 investment would get them $12,000 return. So it's a rather good piece of stock to have if you can demonstrate that you actually have it.
Rob, would you is this going to actually come back to the council as well as the Planning Commission in some future date?
Oh, absolutely. This is going to return to you in April after the Parking Advisory Board and the Planning Commission have reconfirmed their full recommendations, and all of the expansion areas and affected properties and businesses have been noticed, and will notice the April hearing of the council specifically to address the parking credits and the expansion and the application. And it will ultimately be the council's decision as to how to deal with this. We are accompanying it with the development code update, which will change the parking provisions of 1656, so that there will be in-lieu fee capabilities in current districts, including the village area, which is composed now of two districts, the core and the mixed use, and it'll also be available in mixed use districts beyond the village if there is a maintenance provision available. So it will take further action of the council, not scheduled for April, to create such districts on Grand Avenue or some other location requested by owners.
Well, I appreciate all the this is going to be a very interesting public hearing, because I know there's a lot of history behind this, so appreciate that. I'll look forward to that coming before us, because that'll be an interesting public hearing. In regards to the issue before us this evening, I don't have any specific questions in regards to the $12,000 recommended downtown parking, the increased amount. So thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thanks. Okay.
Would it not make more sense to get maybe a little ahead of the curve, and instead of going for the middle ground of 12,000, go to the 14? I know that when we looked at it at the Planning Commission, I know specifically Ira Hughes was against the lower number, and there was definitely not a consensus, I don't think, even at the parking district, to settle on the lower number. My concern is that based on public works programs or projects that we've had, whether it be schools or anything so far, the estimates have not come anywhere close to the reality. And my concern is that we raise a fee and we're already behind. If we, by chance, we're actually a little ahead, it's not that we're not going to spend the money on parking eventually anyways. So I that's my only concern, is I hate to start off with a number that's going to be artificially low.
Again, I think that that's entirely within the discretion of the council. Based upon the land appraisals of $18 plus per foot, assuming we could find unimproved sites, and based upon between 350 and 400 square foot per efficient parking design, and based upon for April, and then that some of the applicants who have been told that we're going to recommend this 12,000 fee, such as Robiscotti and Nestor, et cetera, could appear and comment. Even then, I think those developers will be happy to pay an in-lieu fee rather than have to go out and find, appraise, acquire limited-sized properties for a few spaces. So it's a service, and I think the whole purpose is to encourage parking improvement. So whatever fee you set, as long as it isn't substantially above the actual cost of private development of a space, I think most developers want parking on site if they can have it, but if they can't, they look for an off-site solution or an in-lieu solution.
Thank you. That's all, Mr. Mayor.
Thanks. This is a public hearing. If there's anyone in the audience who would like to comment on 9E, this would be an opportunity. Seeing none, we will close public comment, bring this back. Councilmember Guthrie, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, I do remember when we reviewed this, the Planning Commission questioned the $12,000, but I think you're always dealing with in-lieu fees of being caught in between what anybody would actually use. The fact that nobody's used well, I guess it wasn't available, the 4,000 feet when it was available, and you're always caught between what it really costs to produce the space and what people would actually use. I'm okay with the $12,000. I am a little bit concerned that we may never be able to develop the space, or not in the near future, and that there ought to be some sort of a cap. I don't know if it's possible to do, but some sort of a cap on the number of spaces that could be purchased before we had a project that satisfied them. I certainly have no problem with 20 spaces, but what if there was 100 spaces? Then we would be facing a huge shortfall that we might never satisfy. So I do have some concerns about that, but I can support it as proposed at $12,000 with what's before us tonight. The rest of the information here is good information, but I think it's for a future meeting.
And to clarify that concern, it is the language of the parking chapter of the development code that it requires Planning Commission approval, much like it does a use permit for off-site parking, to allow for in-lieu fees that could also be graduated to the City Council if you desire, so that the actual number of spaces and projects that are able to utilize that in-lieu fee are at your discretion.
Okay, so it's not an entitlement, it's discretionary.
Absolutely.
Okay, then my concern is satisfied.
Councilmember Dickens?
I think that it's in regards to the in-lieu fee and bumping it up to meet our current needs, it's a balance between the actual fee and promoting what's affordable, I guess, in regards to putting dollars that are going to be fairly equitable to the potential of creating some future spaces, in regards to also not inhibiting and keeping those costs so high that deters individuals from actually looking at improving their properties. So I think it's, you know, I think it's a catch-22. I wouldn't be opposed to maybe looking at the higher end if it were council's discretion to instead of the 12,000, maybe go boost it to the 14, because I think that we don't want to be behind the eight ball and not have the funds available when we have the option to possibly secure some property for improved parking. But I wouldn't want to go any further than that at this stage of the game, and I think it does need to be reviewed on an annual basis. So with that, I'll leave it up to council's discretion, but I'm okay with the 12,000. If we were to look at 14, I think that would be all right as well.
Thank you. Councilmember Arnold.
Thank you. I think that we really do need to be looking at the 14 and not 12. I think the difference, most of the projects that are going to utilize this are going to be looking for two or three spaces, and so realistically the difference between the $4,000 or $6,000 difference is probably going to be fairly nominal. But when we start looking at 20 spaces that could be $2,000 or $3,000 short, all of a sudden the shortfall to the city becomes a substantial amount. I definitely believe that the in-lieu fee is a high value that the parking district does provide to the developers, and I don't think there's going to be anybody that's going to balk at the higher number. So I think it would be a missed opportunity not to to take it right now. That's all. Thank you.
Thanks. I can live with the 12 or the 14 if we approve it as is tonight. I'm okay with that if we're going to review this every year, which I think is a good idea, and we get to 14 next year. That's okay, too. And I think the review needs to be based on what we have done in the past. And I know when we were hammering out the design guidelines for the village, I know it's difficult to achieve comps. But on a couple of occasions, we did look at other jurisdictions, to the come to mind are Pacific Grove, Danville, that have a village-type downtown with perhaps similar demographics. There is going to be some geographical issues, some factors that differ, namely land value and location relative to that. But
in terms of similar parking issues around a downtown core similar to ours, it would be nice if we could get a sense of what the range is out there, if we can find something that's reasonably close and comparable. So your mention, Rob, of other communities, maybe we need to go a little bit deeper than just looking at you know, the other communities, but look at some of the factors that they use to establish these things. So I can go either way, either do 12 now and then kick it up to 14 next year after a review, but have the review be based on some sort of substantive research or whatever the case may be. I think ultimately what we're looking for here is to make use of the money in some practical way, and I think the practicality of this has to be additional parking facilities in the village, and that's what we have to shoot for. And so the financing of that endeavor needs to be structured into whatever strategy we have, and it's got to be reasonable. Those are my comments. With that, I'll entertain a motion on...
Mr. Mayor, I'd like to propose a resolution of the City Council of the City of Arroyo Grande adjusting the in-lieu fee for off-site parking in the parking and business improvement areas of the village, with the in-lieu fee being set at $14,000 and with there being a periodic review of that amount of, at a minimum of every 18 months.
I'll second the motion.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Discussion. How's it written in the staff report? Was it written in the staff report that it would be reviewed annually?
I didn't recall seeing anything like that.
I thought I saw that in there, but maybe not.
Periodic cost adjustments.
We did propose the annual review just because that has been what has been done in the past, but I think we will continue to do it on an annual basis, which would fit the criteria that's been provided.
Okay, Mr. Mayor, I'll withdraw the 18-month then.
Is that okay with the second?
Yes.
Just do an annual? Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? Roll call.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
Councilmember Dickens?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Thank you. That takes us to item 11A, new business. Consideration of fiscal year 2005-06 budget goals and 06-07 budget goals.
Okay. Situated here. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. The first step in the city's budget process is to develop recommendations and to obtain feedback from the City Council on overall budget goals and priorities. And this enables the City Council to have input early on into the process, and it also helps staff to make sure that we're on track with City Council's direction prior to investing the significant amount of staff time required to prepare the budget document. It is important to note that this step in the process does not either address or consider funding availability at this time. It is simply a process of prioritization of whatever resources become available at that time. Goals that are identified in which we are unable to identify funding for, those will be programmed or folded into the long-range financial planning process. And in fact, the majority of the goals currently proposed have already been programmed in the long-range financial plan, and staff is trying as much as we can to integrate the long-range financial planning process and the budget process. Now, unfortunately, it appears that we are going to be experiencing yet another very challenging year in balancing the budget due to a number of negative cost and revenue impacts outside the control of the city. As a result, we have identified a few potential expenditures related to service level improvements. However, we believe that the majority of the budget effort will be consumed with developing recommendations on how to address expected shortfalls. And this, given the efficiency efforts that have been implemented over the last few years, this makes it that much more challenging because we're going to, it continues to become more and more difficult to cut city costs without impacting those service levels. As a result, we've identified budget goals, issues, and priorities into two categories this year, discretionary items and non-discretionary items. First of all, are a number of non-discretionary items, which means they're budget impacts that need to be addressed, which we have little control over. First of all, of course, is the impact from the state budget, and the city will lose again this year, approximately $244,000. However, we are expected to receive a return of up to $320,000 the following year. And therefore, staff has recommended this past year and continues to recommend the same, which is to try to address the impact of the state budget on a three-year basis and budget for it on a three-year basis, and therefore the annual net impact over the three-year period is approximately $56,000, which would need to be budgeted for. Secondly, since fiscal year 2000-2001, the city has been utilizing the $100,000 it receives from COP funds to fund a police sergeant position and the upgrade of two officer positions to senior officers. The city expects to continue to receive that funding. However, there is a limit on the amount of time that those funds can be used for any specific purpose. And therefore, staff believes that this upcoming year, the general fund will probably have to absorb those costs if we want to continue to maintain those positions. As you know, PERS retirement rates have been skyrocketing. We had felt that this year those rates would begin to level off, but now it looks like that's another year away from happening. And so we've just started to do some very preliminary estimates, but our projections show that it could increase our cost to the overall city budget by as much as $350,000. So that continues to be a huge item for us to deal with. Excuse me. The city has existing MOUs in place with police and fire associations, which established cost of living adjustments for both groups this upcoming year, for fire the following year, and also for an increase in retirement benefits for fire. Next is priorities, goals, and issues for items that are more discretionary in nature. And first and foremost, given the issues just identified, the primary objective of the budget process again this year will be simply to try to maintain existing service levels. And we feel that's important for a number of reasons. First, the staff feels the city is providing a good level of service to the community. And secondly, we've worked very hard and are very proud of the efforts over the past few very tough budget years to maintain those existing service levels. And so that's a goal to continue that, although, as I mentioned earlier, that becomes tougher and tougher each year. Next is a continuation of an ongoing goal that was established a few years ago to gradually increase funding budgeted for street improvements until we can achieve the appropriate level as established by the pavement management plan. I mentioned MOUs in place with fire and police. This leaves SEIU, which will be negotiating a new agreement this year, and management which is evaluated on an annual basis. And so this will likely result in some additional cost in order for the city to achieve its goal of maintaining competitive compensation. In addition to the goal in the long-range financial plan of trying to gradually increase funding budgeted for street improvements, another one of the goals in the long-range financial plan is to try to establish a vehicle replacement fund, also by each year gradually setting aside some funding until we're able to build up a large enough reserve to establish that fund. We had hoped to begin that process this year. The vehicle replacement fund is the one remaining city financial policy that is yet to be achieved. In terms of staffing, if we were able to add any staffing positions this year, the department directors have met and agreed that the top priority would be the addition of a public works maintenance worker position for street maintenance. This is one of several positions that was eliminated in 1991. Therefore, that particular division's staffing is still less than it was over 15 years ago. Yet, since that time, road miles that they have to maintain have increased significantly. The Let There Be Light program, City Council recently directed staff to proceed with this program to obtain or install decorative streetlights on East Branch in the village. And staff is seeking contributions to cover $3,500 of the cost of the overall $4,000 cost for each light. And therefore, the city needs to budget $6,000 to cover its share of the first phase of 12 lights. We've identified two goals or issues related to the city's computer system. First of all, we've been notified by the county, who we're currently contracting with for maintenance of the computer system, that they are in the process of migrating to a new operating system. And therefore, they will be phasing out their ability to maintain our system. And so, as a result, staff is currently studying the options available to us, but that could result in some potential cost increase if it's determined that we're going to need to also upgrade our system. The other computer-related goal was that now that we have the base GIS system in place in the Public Works Department, a goal in the city is to begin expanding that and networking that system so that it can be utilized better by all the departments throughout the city. The tree program, the staff has been placing an increased focus on both enhancing and preserving city trees within the city. And as a result of that, we're projecting that that will require over time some gradual increase in the supplement to the city's budget for both tree maintenance and tree trimming. And that shouldn't be an initial significant cost, but something that over time we need to supplement that a little bit to maintain the level of service that we're trying to create in that program. Also, as an aside, staff is currently preparing some recommended changes to the tree ordinance and tree program that will be presented to the City Council within the next couple months for consideration that will outline the approach and policy that we're following right now and get direction from Council to make sure that we're in compliance with that. And lastly, last year we put in place a plan for the City Hall project. And as a result of that, we staff is recommending that we establish a project fund in which, as revenues become available, we can begin to set aside some revenues in that fund on an annual basis over a five-year period to be used as one component of the overall five-year funding plan that was developed for that project. In addition to the budget goals and priorities, We've included with your staff report a preliminary schedule for the budget, just to touch on a few key dates. We're targeting May 10th, 2005. We tried to move a few things up here to give us a little more time at the end of the process to work out some potential issues. May 10th is when we're targeting to present to the council or submit to the council the preliminary budget document. On May 8th, 2005, and this is a tentative date, we'll want to check with each of you on your schedules, but you might want to make a note of that and check your calendars and mark it if it is available. That is the date we're currently targeting for the budget study session. And that date's important because if we are able to schedule that session in that time frame, it gives us plenty of time to take back any changes or directions or questions that you have, incorporate those into the final budget document, and have that available for June 14th for adoption. And then the June 14th, we schedule that at that time because in case there's additional questions or additional changes, that still gives us one final meeting in June to, if needed, to come back and adopt the budget within the timeline before the end of the fiscal year. At the bottom here, I mentioned that staff, because we think that this year is going to be a particularly challenging year in balancing and coming up with strategies for the shortfall that we're expecting, we may come forward with an additional step in the process, and that would be to come forward with an outline of the basic budget strategies that we put together to address the expected shortfall. Before we get into putting together the budget document, come forward with some recommended some estimates on what we think the shortfall is going to be, and then just a number of strategies of how we're proposing to address that, and get some direction from City Council once again to make sure we're on track before we start incorporating all that into the preliminary budget. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have. I want to emphasize again, we're not asking for any commitment to any items or expenditures at this point. You're not approving any expenditures. We're just looking for direction from you to let you know whether or not we're on the right track as far as key items that we're focusing on in the budget process. And as I said, we'll come back later as we get more detail and try to get more feedback from you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions on the staff report?
I just have one quick one. On blocking out that time, would it be a normal 7 o'clock meeting? Is it all day?
Unfortunately, in the last few years, we've normally done about a two-hour. Normally, I think it's run about two and a half hours, and I believe the last couple of years we scheduled it at 6:30, but we're flexible. We'll contact each of you and see what times work best and see if that date works best. But I'd assume generally it's been 6:30 to 9 or so, 6:30 to 8:30.
I was just trying to get some kind of ballpark if it needed to be the whole day blocked out or not. So
no.
Okay.
This is the day we bring in at that point a preliminary budget, which means it's not bound yet. It's still all draft numbers. And we spend quite a bit of time going through a presentation of detail in terms of what's included in the budget as far as the numbers, the revenues, and then also each department walks through what programmatic goals they've incorporated into that budget. And then an opportunity for you to get into any questions that you like and any directed changes from the council. We take those back and incorporate them before we bring back the final document for potential adoption.
I'm assuming we're still using the same process that we did when Linda was here. And since we've moved to that process and since the, I don't know whether you call them discretionary or what, but I recall, for lack of a better term, there was a presentation of a wish list on the part of every department head. And I think since you've been here, Steve, you've been able to distill that down into fairly short presentation, which speeds up the process and gets us out of here fairly quickly, not because of the lack of attention, but because of the thoroughness of the report. It comes across well, and it's easily read.
Yeah, we still bring all those requests forward so you can see them, but The change that was made is we provide you our recommendation on those different service level requests rather than just presenting them and letting you go through them.
Do you have questions, Jim?
Mr. Mayor, Steve, there appears to be at least a policy or a goal item that I've seen in the past, and I don't know whether it's been at this particular juncture, but in the past we've had a goal of maintaining a 20% contingency within our general fund. That's not in this report. Are we moving away from that as at least a goal?
Yeah, no, that's one of the policy, and we're going to probably come back and discuss those later on because I kind of just briefly mentioned in the staff report we have a new policy goal we're working on that we want to recommend as it relates to managing PERS expenses over the long term. These are just the budget goals for this particular budget. This assumes that we're trying to achieve each of our budget policies, and that's the 20% is one of the city's financial policies. And the goal is to continue to achieve that. There's a little bit of an impact or relationship with our strategy on how to address the impact to the state of the state funds, because we've said we're going to look at the state funds on a three-year basis to see what the net cost is each year over the three-year period, because we're going to be losing funds for 2 years, getting back funds for the third year. So we figured out the net impact's about $56,000. We're budgeting that. So over the three-year period, there should not be an impact on our reserves. But what you'll see this year, and I think we got the audit just today, we're at about 17% right now. But that's okay because we had programmed into that we would the first 2 years of the lost money from the state, we would go down. And as long as it's not going down below 20% more than what we were losing from the state, it should come up that third year back up to the 20%. That was the strategy. But that's very much our strategy, that the minimum reserve level should stay at 20%. Hopefully, ultimately, we want to get up above that, and above that it can kind of go up and down, but we don't ever want it to go below the 20%. That was probably more of an answer than you were looking for. But
anything else?
And just what is the yearly contribution we're at this point making toward achieving that 20%?
I may have Angela jump in on this. I know it's not so much a contribution at this point because we've achieved it. So it's just one, in the budget process, we're budgeting out our revenues and expenditures and projecting out to ensure that we'll be maintaining that 20% at the end of the year. It also is a key component in our long-range financial plan. We have a column in the bottom, and the key is that over a 10-year period in long-range financial planning, we actually project that revenues and expenditures are going to go up and down. Okay. And what we try to show in that plan is we're never going to let them go down below that 20%. And so
So the contribution from any given – okay. In theory, then, the contribution from any given year going forward would be 20% of whatever the increase that year was in order to maintain the fund at 20% of total revenues.
I think what you're saying, I think I'm understanding it right, our overall budget goes up, so...
Yeah, if our budget went up $100,000...
We just refer to it, it's 20% of the reserves, so we just refer to it as the unfunded balance. But that unfunded balance has to go up proportionally with the rest of the budget, the rest of the budget goes up, or it's, below 20%. It's below 20%.
Right. Yeah. I understand. So it's... Okay. And then a question on the COPS program here, since it will be unavailable to us, I guess, going forward to use it for staffing, what kinds of things can, in fact, we use the state funds for here?
I should have had the chief around. He's an expert on this. But the funds can be – they cannot – let me start with what they cannot be used for. They cannot supplant any existing funds. So you can't take it and use it for any existing expense you have within your budget. It can't be used for construction projects or facilities. We were trying to figure out a way to help it pay for an expansion of the facility. It can only be used for basically enhancements to services. So it could be used for purchasing a police vehicle if that vehicle was part of a new program or a new person we were hiring. Can't be used to replace an existing vehicle. It can be used for staffing if it's newly hired staff, not existing staff. And it can be used for a lot of technology-related items, and that's where, I mean, this is something we're just getting into the budget process. This is the very first discussions, but to give you a little preview, we've already had some discussions about a need by the police department to upgrade their communication system, and this could be an integral part of being able to fund something like that. It would be appropriate for something like that.
And the other questions had to do with the police facility. At one time, it was in the long-range plan as well. Is there, and I don't see it here, but is it still in the long-range plan, just not listed, or is it being funded by another mechanism?
Yeah, I mean, I probably should have just grouped that with the City Hall building. We, as far as strategy of dealing with our facilities, we had kind of come up with a funding strategy that addressed both of those. We also have somewhat of an interim strategy that we may be coming forward to you on that project also. They think they have some opportunity for some temporary units to store on the we're in the process of purchasing and have already budgeted the site next to the police station, which will be used for parking. And the police department has some money in a facility fund that could fund some kind of, you know, temporary units over there. And so some we're working on it. We'll bring a recommendation forward to you.
That's my
near
question.
Future.
Is that it, Jim?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you have anything, Ed?
I just wanted to offer this very quickly, and I don't know the details, but I guess you could put it in the category of a potential revenue source. Yeah. And what I will do tomorrow is take a closer look at the website, but this was sort of hot off the press today, came through OES. And there's a program with the Office of Homeland Security. It's another grant program that supports fire operations. It's a direct federal grant to local fire agencies. And I don't know how the grant is conditioned, but we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars, and we're talking about a program that is going to be sustained. So this may well be a standing grant program as long as Homeland Security remains as a priority at the federal level. I'm led to believe, I just quickly looked at it, that it has the potential for displacing perhaps some of what is in the fire budget. If that's the case, then that might provide us a bit of relief here. And I believe they specifically earmarked equipment facilities like Emergency Operations Center equipment as it might relate to achieving interoperability. So those kinds of things may well do a little bit of gap filling here. I don't know for certain. I do have the webpage site where you can go and apply for the grants. But I know that this is hot off the press. They're in the process of pushing it over to Cal Fire Chiefs. And I'm sure Terry will get something directly. Every fire chief in the nation and will, I'm sure, be applying for this. But certainly California has a justification perhaps to move up in the queue in terms of the application. So I'll get more details for you and forward it to both of you tomorrow.
Yeah.
And you
can
go take a look.
I'll also forward it over to Dave Matthey in our fire department. He's doing a great job on grant applications right now.
Okay.
And we also want to give you some kudos too. Angela's, they'll be coming back with a report fairly soon on the investment, looking at her review of the investments at your request. And we do think that there's some opportunity there at this point without modifying some investments within our current investment policy. But given our reserves that we've built up, one of the advantages of that, it gives us a little flexibility to maybe tie some money down in a little longer, with a little less liquidity and be able to get us a little additional money. So I'll, I don't want to steal her thunder. She'll come back with that at the next meeting or so. But.
Well, if it's a successful strategy, Angela, you have to fill me in on it because I got adventurous with my 401k last month and wished I hadn't. So...
yeah.
Anyway.
Adventurous isn't a word we want to use.
Yeah. No.
The approach we're taking.
This is not a public hearing, but if there is a member of the audience that would like to come forward and comment on 11A, this would be a time to do it. No one? Okay. We'll close that. Bring it back to council for action. Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Steve, thanks for bringing this forth. There's still a lot of questions, of course, that need to be answered. I see a lot of, between the non-discretionary and discretionary items, a lot of money's going out, and still we've got to talk about the money's coming in and how that's looking. But at this point, we're talking about budget goals, and I think that everything that you have before us are issues that are need to be addressed, and we need to at least... try our best to budget and have goals set to meet these needs. So I think it's very appropriate. So thank you.
Councilmember Arnold.
Very unenviable time to be doing budgets, obviously, but I think the goals that have been set out here are very good goals. I think the goal of continuing the high level of service that we provided our citizens is a good goal. And to continue with our reserves is also one. So I support this budget goal.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Yeah, and I don't know whether you're looking for feedback. I don't have any additional goals here, although I do think from a priority standpoint, a couple of these, at least in my mind, have lower priority if, in fact, we come up short here. I'm looking... at the City Hall project, I think that that may have to get pushed off to start being at least the general fund contribution that to a couple of years from now when we are beyond whatever the state situation is. I'm also thinking probably that's true with the maintenance worker position as well. I would say that if there are, and probably the vehicle replacement fund, which I realize we still have to kind of deal with probably an emergency basis when the vehicles go down, but I do think that those are kinds of things that once things have settled down with the state and we have a much better picture of going forward, that they might be more appropriate at that point. I do think that one of the key things here is going to be the street improvement program. I realize that that's certainly among citizens, at least their priority, because visually that's what they see. So if there were, I hate to use the word discretionary because there really isn't any discretionary money here, but if there were funds left over at the end of the year because we underestimated revenues or something like that, I think that would probably be the appropriate place would be to be increasing that particular goal there to bring that up to speed maybe before some of the other facility issues. Thank you.
I just to add on that, I mean, that's pretty consistent with a lot of staff's discussion. And one of the criteria we use in that is items that, for example, street improvements, when we do not invest the appropriate amount of money in that on an ongoing basis, it actually costs us more money in the long run. That's why we're trying to get up to that level. So we try to look on in long term which of the ones are just, you know, delaying later costs or which are truly costs that if we could hold off for a couple of years, it's not going to make that much difference. So it's kind of, I think, consistent with, I think, what you were saying.
Thank you. Well, I want to, was that it?
Yeah, that was it.
Okay. I just wanted to commend both you, Steve, and Angela for putting this together because these are clearly challenging times for us. And I think what you've laid out here in the way of budget goals and priorities are reasonable. I think it represents some sound planning. There's enough flexibility in here, I think, for us to adjust if we need to take a more of a contingency approach. But I think going back to something that you said, Jim, about the uncertainties of the next 2 years, one of the reasons why we negotiated so strongly, when I say we, I'm saying our city as part of the League of Cities and working with the governor, was so that through Prop 1A, we could have some certainty as to what the budget impact would be for the next 2 years. I'm hoping that that materializes in the way that we've all agreed that it will. And he realized that for this two-year window, there needed to be a degree of certainty. We needed to be able to plan with a more definitive factor of the impact of the shortfall for the next 2 years, with the understanding that there would be some structure that would engage on the back end that would fill. And, it was based on that certainty that, gap loan programs and things like that engaged. So I'm reading into what you proposed here, Steve, that certainty, that stability on the other end 2 years hence. So, and I read this as a document that does have some flexibility structured in, so that if worst case scenario, if everything we negotiated in Prop 1A doesn't come forth, that we can go back to that list and we can revisit as necessary. So I can support this as proposed. So with that, we'll entertain a motion for 11A.
Mr. Mayor, I would move that the council approve the proposed budget goals for fiscal year 2005-06 and fiscal year 2006-07.
We have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Any discussion on 11A? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Diggins?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Arnold?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. Thank you. Okay. That takes us to City Council reports. I'm first on the list. The January SLOCOG meeting was canceled. We meet next Wednesday. And South County Sanitation District, I attended both meetings. And over the course of those two meetings, we discussed the situation with a potential assessment of the sanitation district relative to Zone 1 and 1A. The reparations to Arroyo Grande Creek. Not much to report at this point. We're still looking into it. We also reviewed the 2005 budget. Recently, you may have seen a picture in the paper. There's a groundbreaking for a major component of the plant. And without going into a lot of detail, it's called a chlorine contactor and effluent pumping station. I don't think you want me to go into a great bit of detail, but it's a $2 million project. And it's part of the district's long-range capital improvement plan, should be completed in November of this year. A couple of other things that fall in the other category. I traveled to Los Angeles last Thursday to chair the Public Safety Policy Committee for the League of Cities, and we approved our work plan for the year. Heard several enlightening presentations regarding sexually violent predators. Particularly of concern to some of the jurisdictions, ours in particular, with the Atascadero State Hospital, and also difficulty that some jurisdictions are having with the medical marijuana issue. And so fortunately, we were fortunate enough to have the chief take a preemptive strike until we got some clarification on the pull between the federal law and the state law. And we were able to share that ordinance at the Public Safety Policy Committee meeting, and everyone was appreciative. Also attended the annual City Selection Committee, and we elected new officers. These are all the mayors of the seven cities in SLO County. We appointed Mayor Wendy Scalise from Atascadero to the California ID Advisory Board, and we appointed Police Chief Joe Cortez of Pismo Beach to the Supplemental Law Enforcement Oversight Committee. Those are the only two appointments that were up. As soon as that selection committee meeting was over, we went into our mayor's meeting, which is a monthly activity, And we were very fortunate to have Assemblymember Sam Blakesley visit with his new staff. He's very cordial and very active, and I was very impressed with the fact that he's positioned himself in a very influential way, especially for a freshman assemblyman. You're fortunate if you have one or two committee assignments, and Mr. Blakely was assigned to four key committees, agriculture, utilities, budget, and he's also vice chair of the PERS committee. So he is in a position, I think, to be very influential and work on our behalf, and he stated that he had a very strong desire to do that. And the last activity that I participated in was a State of the Cities presentation, which is now hosted on an annual basis by the three chambers of commerce in Pismo, Grover, and Arroyo Grande. So I participated in making a presentation on behalf of the city along with Mayor John Scholes and Mayor Marianne Reese, and seemed to go fairly well. Good lunch.
And well represented.
Yeah. And that pretty much wraps up my activities. Mayor Pro Tem is not here. We wish Joe a speedy recovery. He's ill. And move to Councilmember Dickens.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mine's going to be extremely brief. The South County Area Transit doesn't meet again until February 16th, so I have no report. And I believe the South County Youth Coalition meets this Thursday, the 27th. So I have no report there as well.
Councilmember Arnold.
Mine's going to be about as short. The Integrated Waste Management Authority Board canceled their January meeting. Our next meeting is in March. The California Joint Powers Insurance Authority doesn't meet till the summer. The only other thing I did attend was last Saturday. There was a Places 2050 for the South County. I attended that. There was good turnout. The consensus, I would say, was for the type of growth that we're proposing here in Arroyo Grande, which is a fair amount of redevelopment, protecting the ag land. So based on what I heard from the South County, we are on track with what the people want.
Good. I was hoping to attend that, and I couldn't make it, but I'm glad you were there. Councilmember Guthrie.
Yeah, I did attend the December meeting of the Economic Vitality Commission. They are close to hiring a new executive director. The next meeting is tomorrow afternoon, and I do see there's at least a report from the search committee, so I suspect they're going to be proposing a hire there. I also attended that meeting in the South County and would report the same thing Ed did there, that there's definitely support for the same kind of goals that that we support here in Arroyo Grande. I also attended a League of Cities 3-day seminar. I will say it's a pretty intense seminar, 15-minute breaks in between. They don't fool around. And there's learned an awful lot of stuff. I would highly recommend that to Ed or to anybody else who can go through that program. There's a lot of good stuff there. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. Takes us to item 13, City Council member items. We have none this evening. City manager items.
Yes, Mr. Mayor and members of the council, I do have one item. As you probably were expecting, we received a letter from the city of Pismo Beach asking if we would be interested in participating in a study to review the potential for Pismo Beach and actually Oceano also joining our arrangements or our joint partnership with Grover Beach for fire services. And in speaking with both the chief and also some of our fire personnel, I've certainly gotten a lot of feedback that they believe from an operational standpoint there's the possibilities for some real additional operational benefits as far as the services to the public. From my standpoint, so we're very encouraged with the potential. There's also a number of issues that would need to be addressed that don't really, come up with the arrangement with Rover Beach, with three cities or four jurisdictions, the whole operational structure is going to get a little more complicated. We may have to identify additional, management staff within the structure. So I just point that out because there's a lot of issues that need to be looked at. So I think it requires a more detailed study than we did when we worked on coming up with recommendations with Grover Beach. The good news is the city of Pismo Beach has offered to fund that study. So they're asking us at this point is just whether we would, be willing to participate in that study. And so from a staff standpoint, considering the potential benefits, we would recommend going ahead, but wanted to get feedback from the council first. If there's any concerns about it, we could place it on the formal agenda for deliberation. But at this point, I just wanted to see if there was any opposition from me telling them to go ahead and at least participate in the study with no commitment beyond that, obviously.
Let me ask a question here. It says no formal action can be taken. If we all agree that we want to go ahead with a study, is that a formal action, Tim? I don't mean to split hairs here, but I was hoping just wondering if maybe we shouldn't bring it back and put it on the agenda. I mean, I can tell you right now that I don't have any problem moving ahead with a feasibility study. I guess my question is, if we all say that, does that constitute a formal action?
I do think it constitutes a formal action. And if in the absence of the manager's authority to move it forward independent of you, I think it requires some formal action and you can't take it here. I don't think I was supposed to say that's the truth, though.
Okay. Well, then
I'd like to point out that the manager disagrees with my analysis.
Well, let's have other members of the council chime in on this. I don't have a problem. I think at this point, informally, Steve, myself, I don't have any problem moving ahead and gathering more information, which is all you're asking to do here. But I think I would feel better about it if it came back as a and you could pass that on to, Mary Ann if you wanted to. But I think I'd feel better about it if it came back as an agenda item so we would have an opportunity to maybe look into it further.
Yeah, whatever your preference is, I'm comfortable with. I don't think it makes any
How's everybody
any
else
difference
feel?
To me. The reason I put it on this is I think I I think just by the letter I probably have the authority to get back to him and let him know that we'll at least participate because we're not appropriating any money or anything. We're just participating, but I wanted to get your feedback and okay before I do that. But if you'd feel more comfortable with bringing it back on a formal item, I'm fine with that too. I don't think there's any huge timeline here, and either way won't cause any problems. So.
I guess the only reason why I mention it is it would be interesting to kind of get a feel for if there's any public input, get a feel for how people feel about it.
Sure.
That would be helpful. Don't leave me out here hanging. Come on, guys.
I have no problem with gathering information that doesn't cost us any money.
Yeah. I'm certainly not opposed to investigating any possibilities. My concern is that we went through this process not too long ago. My concern, and I'll just voice it, is that it's not the money issue. It's the staff time that is going to be put into this particular effort. We've been there, it didn't result. I think it resulted in something good, but I think there's some discussion that needs to be warranted in regards to our funding and also staff resources in this particular joint effort.
Well, I obviously appreciate your sensitivity to our staffing resources, and there will be some efforts required on all the agencies and their staff. Although I do think it's a key component is that they're willing to fund the study, and that'll definitely cover the majority of the work that would be involved, and would certainly reduce our I would be much more skeptical if they felt we were all going to partner equally in terms of trying to put this study together.
Yeah, I don't have any objection. I'm not sure that it could even just be a consent item if you're uncomfortable with it rather than a full public hearing, but whatever you and the mayor think.
I'm not uncomfortable either way. It's pretty, however you want to prefer to go forward.
Well, I think we're all comfortable enough for you to respond accordingly to the letter. But maybe as just an information item, if you put it on new business or something like that, we can at least offer the opportunity to the public to come forth and comment, even though it doesn't have to be a public hearing. But
that's a good idea.
Okay.
So we'll have that. I'll just put that on the next agenda.
Okay.
And if I could just suggest, and when that comes back to us, just a recommendation to maybe look at past efforts so that we know what we've done in the past as part of just an educational component.
And, based on what Jim raised a good point, if maybe we can talk about, when it comes back, we can talk about the scope of the study, what it's going to address, who from our staff is going to be involved in it, some of those kinds of things that, maybe put our mind to ease or not. So it'd be some additional amplification on that, we obviously can't go into now. So be a good information item.
Because I know there was a number of questions when we did the recent joint effort focusing on police. There was a lot of individual issues. So maybe if I can get that scope, it would be helpful for us to get some comments from you early on so I can pass those on.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Council Communications, item 15.
Mr. Mayor, if I could, I probably should have done it under City Council member items, but in the past, I believe a couple years ago, we did a proactive approach and invited our newly elected state representatives here to the city so that we could articulate some of our positions and so forth. And I think that it, especially after what the mayor just talked about and some of the positions that Mr. Blakeslee is in, it might behoove us to maybe set something up in the future to have us meet with our newly elected state representatives and articulate some of the important items for the city.
Good suggestion.
Mr. Mayor, I have one item. Awesome. This probably should have been under council member items also. Unfortunately, I only read this afternoon. Once again, in priority focus, this is going to obviously be something that I'm looking at hard. I was definitely concerned about, on the last page, about the Assemblymember Petra, I believe, or maybe it was a senator, statement that he wants more control, lawmakers proposing to take some zoning power away from cities. Definitely concerns me that the state thinks they know what zoning would be better for us, and I don't know if it's something that we might want to look at as preparing a letter as a response to that, because I don't think we should be silent on something so serious.
Great. Yeah, well, I'm glad you pointed that out, and we will follow up on that. This is something that's, as the mayor can tell you, it's an ongoing effort by the state to do that, just that, and we've had to be very diligent in responding to those because they lose on one bit of legislation and it comes right back. So it's a constant battle.
Yeah, and I, at some point in the near future, I think if you haven't met him already, Councilmember Guthrie and Arnold, we need to introduce you to Dave Mullinax, who's the grassroots representative from the League of Cities, which is where that priority focus comes from. And they stay on top of legislation as it comes forth, particularly housing legislation. And anything that tends to shift local control to the state, the League opposes. And so Dave is usually right on top of that. And, in fact, if you haven't already, you're probably going to start getting a ton of emails from him indicating that it's time to write a letter and be quick about it. And Steve is usually pretty good about staying on top of that. And we all share those concerns. And I think the league puts it in there as kind of an admonishment to be on the lookout for those kinds of things. And the legislators that draft that kind of state control, one-size-fits-all legislation usually make the list, and it's not a nice one. So, but your point is well taken. Okay, any other council communication? Staff communication?
No, sir.
Okay. Takes us to item 17, community comments and suggestion. This is an opportunity to invite any member of the public to come through with any issues, thoughts, suggestions. Comments should be limited to those matters that are within the jurisdiction of the council. No? Okay, we'll close item 17, and that takes us to adjournment.
So moved.
Second.
Great. Thank you, gentlemen.